cause we love them.
Them a call us pirates. Them a call us illegal broadcasters. Just because we play what Carl wants.
So them a call us
pirates.
Them a call us
illegal broadcasters.
Try
stop us, but they can't.
And they motherfucking won't.
Can't stop, won't stop.
Mm-mm.
We're back.
What? It's been like, what, do your thing.
Welcome to the Interracial John Podcast. I am your host, At Lizzie Mack, and I'm joined by my co-host, as always,
Very White Guy.
And you are a very white indeed. Holy crap, we're back.
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
It's been a long, like a week plus.
This is the longest we've gone since we started doing the podcast.
That's what happened when nobody pays us.
Well, we both did other podcasts, so we were still out here doing stuff, but not our podcast. And I'm psyched just for it to be me and you talk about all of our crap.
Yeah, it's been a while.
It's sweet. Yeah. All right. If you're just joining us or if you don't know already, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. You can also find us on our website, interracialjohn.com. And of course, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr. Again, that's at Interracial John, J-A-W-N. So what's up, dude?
I'm glad to be podcasting. It's been a while. We said this before. I really like sitting down and kind of going over what we're going to talk about and having things we're going to talk about. And then, you know, just doing this podcast. I find it a couple therapy time.
It is. It's like a focused time to listen to each other.
What'd you just say? I do want to actually talk. We had our itinerary, and I don't want to diverge because we've got a schedule to keep.
Yeah.
But, I'm just learning a lot with the movement and what movement work looks like. And I have not struck the right balance between work, life, health. And I feel obsessive compulsive about some of this stuff.
Yeah.
I feel kind of, you know, emotionally drained. And
people are dying. It's hard not to feel.
I don't talk with you about my white issues. There's a couple different Facebook groups. Ivy runs one that I really like. And we were talking about this, and someone called it second string pain. You know, so, you know, white folk feeling emotionally drained and, you know, struggling with stuff. It's not the pain. It's not, you know, real pain. But it's pain. It's real. It's emotion. But it's not the pain that people of color and black folk are feeling. You know, it's very different. It's second string pain, I think, is an accurate description. But it is sort of, you know, tangible.
I mean, it's painful. It's painful to watch. And certainly, I think that empathy is possible on the part of all. So, and from empathy also comes pain. Just yeah. part of that.
Well, and some of the other things that, and you, I have to say, you're much more versed at a lot of this stuff. I've been doing it longer, but this sort of, and I don't want to name any group specific, but this infighting and this sort of division, and I just, I'm like, you know, when people get a little bit of influence and power, they I don't want to say they sell out for the money. I don't know what's going on with this one issue that's happening now in this one group, but it's just discouraging. You know,
it is and it isn't. I mean, it's just the nature of it. It's foolish to think that any movement, whether it's social justice or not, won't have the same interpersonal issues at play that other things will.
Mm.
So for me, I don't really take it as discouraging. It's just a part of human nature. And there's assholes everywhere and there's egos everywhere. And these are just things that you have to deal with. But it is one of the reasons why I've decided to make a lot of my work very insular. And why I've been kind of small focused. Not that the impact is small, but that I've been small in terms of what I'm doing and how many people I allow to interact with me in the production part of things.
It certainly gives you some nimble and flexibility and decision-making control, right?
It does. It does. I mean, there obviously it's great to have more people involved, but, you know, for me, it's been good to kind of have that control and slowly bring people in as I need them and as it organically is useful. You know, doing large calls for people to come and help, it just opens up a lot of things. And there's areas where that's necessary. When you're planning a huge action or a large scale thing that's going to be in a real place, you need a lot of people to do that. But I think one of the strengths of this movement has been so many of the organizations that have developed have not been about doing actions, but in supporting other people in doing actions. And it's why they've been so successful. And you see Ferguson Action, you see Operation Help Her Hush, you see Justice League in New York City. There's so many organizations that have sprung up, and their goal is not for them to do the planning, because I think that is where a lot of the ego issues come in, but for them to support people that are doing the planning. And it allows people to use their interpersonal skills where it works and their organizational skills where it works.
And
when you try and merge the two is where I have seen a lot of the issues come into play.
And we've discussed this, and I've listened to your shout out to the Ferguson Response Network podcast, where you've talked about the sort of multi-headed Hydra approach that this movement is taking. It has a lot of benefits in that, you know, you can't kill one leader and end the movement. There's certainly opportunity for multiple people to do things. But for me, there's a weird intersection with, you know, hearing from, you know, leaders and DeRay and folks in the movement, yourself, you know, if there's something you want to do, just do it.
Yeah.
If there's an action, do it. And then for me, doing that action, there's this odd kind of, you know, is this white knighting? Is this, you know, white savior? Why am I doing this? What's the purpose? Is it really going to be beneficial? Is there ego involved? And all of those are valid questions, and I'm aware of them. But it sometimes thinking about those things paralyzes my ability to act, if that makes any sense.
No, it does make sense, and I do get that. I think a lot of people get paralyzed by the possibility of their actions being taken the wrong way. But really, I don't see that as something to really worry about. One, because if it really goes into the wrong direction, you'll know pretty quickly. And two, you know, I always have a very standard response when anybody tries to question something that I'm doing, and I'll say, well, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, and frequently the person saying that to you, they're not doing anything. So my whole thing is this: if you, I am not a believer in intent trumping outcome. I actually think that's not the case. Outcome is always going to trump intent. But I think that you're a smart person, and you can think through the large, pitfalls that there might be there, and then adjust as you need to. I mean,
yeah, and
it just is what it is.
I think that's part of why I've done some of the things I have done, because it's like, well, you know, I know what my intent is, and I've thought through things, and if the outcome isn't what I thought the outcome is, okay, I'll adjust, I'll pivot, and I'll go back to the drawing board. I'm not going to be discouraged or dissuaded. But, and you said this the other night, we were talking about it off the podcast. You said, well, has any black person accused you of being a white knight? I said, not to my knowledge. I said, okay, when that happens, then you can worry.
Yeah, I did. I was just like, you know, when someone black says to you, hey, dude, this isn't cool, well, you know, listen to them and talk about it. But I have heard a lot of that paralyzing talk coming from white people that are in the movement or want to be in the movement. And I think there's a role for everybody to do everything. But I don't believe that, I believe that there is a role for white leadership in this struggle, not necessarily in the Black Lives Matter movement, but in the struggle to achieve something closer to equality in this country. There has to be.
I literally just had this argument, and an individual on the hashtag white silence, right? It was kind of popular, went on.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. I thought it was great. I thought, you know, got people talking. I was encouraged seeing people of color in get involved and sort of, you know, here's what white silence makes us feel like. And there was an individual just connected with him, a black person, that was espousing the view that this is sort of not helpful, and that black liberation, if you will, should not, does not, and cannot need, necessitate, require kind of white action, white permission, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't disavow him of that.
I do.
Hakeem, I'll shout out. No, I don't. He can have that opinion, and he can work towards that goal, and I don't disavow him of that opinion. My comment was, you know, I, as a white person, think talking to white people about supremacy and, you know, white silence, I think that's important. In my opinion, at some point, this movement is going to take a lot of different people in disparate roles. It's probably going to include some white folk, and engaging and opening up and awakening white folk, I think that's helpful in the movement. I think that's my, I don't want to say responsibility, but that's the lane that I come from. My history and perspective as a privileged white male, I'm going to talk to other privileged white people about that. And so he was, you know, I don't say he was tearing it down, but he was questioning it. And we, kind of agreed to say, listen, you know, if this is helpful, great. He'll do what he does. I'll do what I do. But, it, you know, there is, and I'm not blaming Hakeem at this, but I got a whole shit ton of just, and this is a new term to me, concern trolls. Mm. So the you know, overt troglodyte, oh, yeah, racist, like, you know, epithet hurling troll, you see those a mile away. Block, 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 block. These guys come in with this sort of like, oh, I just want to ask a question. I'm just concerned. And you made this statement. And did you know that race is a social construct? And what about this? And, you know, various, you're doing it wrong. You should do it this way. And I'm always like, you know what? The fuck are you doing?
I don't reply to anybody that asks me a question in response to a tweet.
Hmm. I might have to start that.
I don't. I just don't. They shouldn't have any questions for me. Say what you have to say. How about that? Twitter is not a place for me to ask you a question and get an answer unless we're doing like an ask me situation, yeah, which I don't do. It just isn't.
I'd like to see that.
No, no, but I've no.
Just me and you.
To.
I'll do it. You're going to ask me.
There's a new thing, ask.fm. It's kind of cool, actually. Dumila Lemieux did it yesterday, I think it was. It was kind of neat. People get to ask her questions, and she tweeted out answers to them. It was an interesting thing. Anyways, yeah, I mean, yeah, the concern trolls are stupid. But I do not if you are asking me a question about something I tweeted, yeah, no. A, because anything I tweet, you can fucking Google it and find out anything you want to about it. And I'm not here to fucking educate you.
Yeah.
I'm on Twitter sharing information I think is important and stating my opinion. And I don't need you to tell me what you think about it. You can retweet it and you can add your comments to it to people that follow you. That's all great. That's what Twitter's there for. But for me, I'm not here to use it as a tool to educate any individual specific people. So the minute you ask me a question, I call bullshit.
Yeah, the problem is I do feel that the, you know, the platform that Very White Guy has on Twitter is, you know, I've responded. I engage with people. I want white people to ask me questions. So I do. There's a little bit of a,
yeah, I mean, I guess for you it's different. Yeah, for you it's different. Yeah. I don't use Twitter that way. But that's, yeah, why I don't have as many followers, well, as you. So.
And I'm definitely with the question thing. I refuse to answer any of this. Like, don't you think, or, you know, isn't your opinion this? Like, no, don't fucking ask me, don't you think, and shouldn't your opinion be this? State your opinion. I'll reply to that.
Exactly. You
know? But so I think some of the other rules I'm going to put in place now, used to be no eggs. And I think you said this the other day, no dogs or weird looking.
No dogs, no cats.
No dogs. Or I really know, if you have a dog and a cat and you have less than 50 followers, you're probably not going to get me to
say. No, I'm not kidding. Any dog or cat.
No, I have some people I engage with that have dogs and cats.
They're not real people, babe. I'm telling you, for real. I'm dead serious. I don't give a shit who you think you're engaging with, but it's not a real person.
Well, I'm not willing to castigate dog and cat photos because I have a lot of them.
As an avatar on Twitter, you're fake. Right. Cut it out, people. Just stop.
Well, so that was all. I this whole working within the movement, I haven't found my balance. I haven't found the, you know, where I'm most comfortable. I'm still feeling, you know, kind of awkward in certain instances. I feel like I'm not doing enough. Am I doing too much? Am I doing things for, you know, this reason or ego? And I say ego, but in my opinion, I think every action almost anyone ever does at some level has a little bit of, how am I being perceived? You know, how am I looking to other people? I think to say that that doesn't exist is sort of false, but
yeah, except for me, like, I really don't give a shit what people think of me. It's a problem.
I do know that. I'll second that. I'm glad that you give a shit about me, but you know what you just said, like, in our relationship, I don't mean to get all like real, like, you know, couples therapy on a podcast, but so at times I've had this sort of you know, like, geez, are you mad at me? Like, do you still love me? Like, I get kind of sensitive. I think it's because you have an air of, I don't give a fuck.
I don't. I really don't. It's an Emma chick problem, actually. We all have it. I don't know.
You know, I think it makes you powerful.
It really does. I mean, I there are cons to it, but I really don't care. So I'm just kind of like, I'm usually in a mode of like, well, if I think it's what I want to do or what I need to do, I'll just do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's what it is.
Hey, I'll give a little shout out. And I know that this has been stated and referenced. I'm just going to repeat it again and again and again. Women of color, black women are moving this movement. Like, I don't want to say black women don't get enough credit, but I'm continually impressed, surprised, you know, by the volume of black women that are really making a difference. And so today I had yet another, you know, a little ding for patriarchy interaction with someone that I DM'd, and we're kind of going back and forth. And I was like, holy shit, I'm not surprised that you're a woman. What bothers me is that it didn't even fucking, like, my mind so instantly in the patriarchy conditioning just assigned this individual as a man, whether it was based on their tweets, their actions, their handle, I don't know what, but something in my mind said, this is a man. And then it never, ever, ever occurred to me to think, well, maybe they're a woman. Mm. Until the person said, oh yeah, this makes this lady happy. I was like, oh, holy shit, I did it again. Patriarchy over the head.
Patriarchy is fucking deep.
I always say my lens for racism and supremacy is well attenuated, focused, but my own patriarchy just, fuck, I stumble over it.
It's funny because I assume everybody's a woman.
I like that. In fact, that's the conditioning I should probably try to do.
Yeah, start working on that shit.
Everyone's a woman.
You're all women.
You're a man.
You're a woman until you prove to me that you aren't worthy of being called one.
Well, and when I said about this being a woman, I said, oh my God, it's so crazy. She's like, yeah, you know, we women are pretty fucking awesome. I was like, yeah, my wife, you know, runs circles around me intellectually in all kinds of different ways.
You're pretty smart, so let's not get too carried away. All right, well, let's get started
here. Do it.
Holiday has come and gone, our Christmas extravaganza here at the homestead. We had my whole family here, which was pretty fun.
Awesome.
14 people in all. We did a lot of awesome stuff. Everybody arrived Christmas Eve, and my last sister left Monday. So we had a really nice long weekend with everybody. 10 adults, 4 children, I guess 4. Well, 9 adults, 1 teenager, and 4 children.
Hey, we had 4 generations.
We sure did. We had 4 generations. You're right.
Mom.
Yeah, mom
is a great grandma.
She is.
And then she's got.
She had her 3 daughters. She had her sons. Two grandsons and three granddaughters, because Sierra and the 2 girls.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we had 2 great granddaughters.
Daughters, yeah.
Yeah, with a lot of them. So the kids were hilarious, so funny. And we had just, you know, hanging out, playing music and everything. That first night's always so fun with everybody just kind of like relaxing. We usually play games, and I had some crafts for everybody to do, which was really fun when everybody got here. And then we had Christmas dinner, of course, which we did early because we took the whole goddamn family to see Annie at the Fancy Theater.
Wasn't that nice?
So fun. First of all, the movie was fantastic.
It was really good. I and we don't have to get too into Annie, but man, the whole she's black, that was a pile of shit. It was just a really good movie.
It really was. It was a great update.
An update, a reimagining.
It was really great update. It was so modern. And a lot of the, I mean, we don't need to go into the whole thing, but I loved a lot of the remixing of the songs, but also some of the imagery that they decided to go with was just so beautiful and lovely, and I loved it, and the kids loved it, and we went to the fancy theater that has the reclining seats, and the kids loved that, and it was great. We had a great time.
Yeah, there was a tweet from one of my Black Girl Maine's husband. I can't remember his name, but he said that Annie made him smile because it was one of the first times that his daughter, so he's got a biracial daughter, mm-hmm. Saw someone in a movie that looked like her.
Aww.
I thought, man, that's fantastic.
That is awesome. It was really good. I loved it. And the kids loved it. And we took up like 2 whole rows at the theater. It was fantastic.
We rolled deep.
We did. We rolled deep up in there. And I had my great niece sitting next to me, and the theater gets kind of cold. So I had, one of my circle scarves, but like the big one, you know, that almost is like a blanket when it's not in scarf mode. And she leans over and she says, Auntie, I'm cold. And I grabbed my scarf and I threw it on her. And she says, where did you get that blanket from? She's so funny.
She turned 4 while here.
She turned 4 Sunday. So she cute. Is hilarious.
Don't you love that 3-and-a-half-year-old, like, scratchy little voice?
Oh, the scratchy voice is the best. And her facial expressions are like, I mean, honestly, she has this whole eyebrow thing she does. She like full on looks at you like, don't do that. Like, she's great. I just love her.
And she's like, honestly, as a 4-year-old, she should be a baby model.
She's gorgeous.
And my mom, Crystal's gorgeous.
Yes.
And was a model, so it doesn't surprise me.
Does not. She has very handsome and very beautiful parents, and she is equally gorgeous. Them girls is getting tall, though.
Yeah.
She's about tall as a 7-year-old.
I hope.
Zoe, good God. She's taller than my mom.
I don't be inappropriate, but face getting little boobies.
Aww.
It's like I held her in my hand like 12 years ago, and I'm like, oh my God, she's turning into a teenager.
She is. She's a tween. Next year she'll be a teen for
sure. And did you notice that she was much more independent?
Oh, yeah. She's very adult now. The younger kids turn, were, yeah. This turn at 12 has been significant. From last year to this year, it's pretty significant change in her.
Much more into her... iPad.
Her iPad, yeah, and her kids. Stuff she wants to do. Yeah. She helped me so much in the kitchen. She made the pulled pork and she made the rub for it and everything.
I went with her to the train station a couple times.
Yeah, she's great. God bless her.
That's our goddaughter. Love you, Faith.
And then we had a few cool things that we also did. One was for dessert on the day after Christmas. We did a make your own pie station.
I'm going to just pause right here. And just for people that don't know, my wife Leslie's like, the entertainer extraordinaire. She's part of her background is hosting and doing events for various organizations, including the company I work for. And when we do parties, like, I love you, babe, but you can't do anything on like less than 11.
Why would I do it on 11?
I know. And that's why I love it. I love it. But so you do this sort of like make your own bar with various things.
Yeah, I like make your own stuff. It's fun.
Last year it was a make your own hot chocolate.
Yeah, yeah, that was nice.
That was a blast.
Yeah, that was a good one.
I got drunk on that.
Yeah.
So this year it was a make your own pie station. I thought it was super cool.
It was cool. It was really neat. So we got the like pre-made like graham cracker crust mini pie shells. And then we had all sorts of fillings. We had pudding. We had, you know, the regular filling like apple pie, peach pie, all that kind of stuff. We had... custard as well. We had a banana custard.
Custom chocolate chips.
We had chocolate chips to top and sprinkles.
Whipped cream.
Oh, yeah. We had everything.
Stacks pound cake.
Yeah, we had pound cake. We had all sorts of stuff. It was really good. The kids loved doing it. It was really fun, and everybody had a good time.
You know what? I did mine. I took the pie crust out of the tin and just put it on a plate and like...
Piled everything.
Yeah. It was like 2% crust and 10% filling.
Hilarious.
80% whipped cream.
That's pretty funny. And then we had one day where we all went into Philadelphia as well. So we went to the African American Museum of Philadelphia, which was really great. They had an amazing exhibition there called Cash Crop. Really visually, moving and... it was based on the drawing of slaves in a slave trade ship, how they would be, stored, for lack of a better word, because that's really what it was.
It was in England, where they had just passed a law somewhere in, I think, the 1800s, where there was the limit how many slaves you could have on a ship. It was like 450.
Mm-hmm.
And the individual, I think, made one of the best infographics ever. Drew a slave ship.
What it would look like. Yeah.
And how to get 450 bodies in, side by side.
To that space.
Head to toe.
Right.
And it really kind of allowed people to say, wow,
this is inhumane.
Yeah.
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 So the artist took that rendering and he kind of used it to make all sorts of different ways of interpreting it. Some were in iron. There was one that was in weave, one that was etched into like a foam board. And then he had some life-size figures in stone. It was really very, very moving. I thought it was really effective piece.
You should put the picture. Can you add a picture to our...
Yeah, I can put a picture up. I put a link for sure.
Yeah, so we'll link the picture, but it was definitely moving, but it was also a little bit jarring.
Yeah.
And so the kids ranged from 4 to, I think, 12.
15.
All right, so but the 12-year-old, Faith, she was really almost nervous. She said it looks creepy.
Yeah.
I felt, not bad, but I said, listen, it is uncomfortable, but we need to be okay with viewing this as an uncomfortable thing.
Yeah, because it happened.
Yeah, it's our history.
Well, it's funny. We're going to be talking with my new co-host, Ricky Hines. Shout out to you, Ricky, AUA Podcast.
Oh, he's officially the co-host
He
now?
Is the official co-host of the Ferguson
Ding for that.
Response Network Podcast. But one of the issues we're talking about recording on Thursday actually is the role of children and teenagers in the movement and what types of things they can do, which actually leads me into some other two cool things that happened, which was, and you guys have probably heard us talking about the I Can't Breathe Challenge or the Reclaim the Dream Challenge, which was to sing the I Can't Breathe protest song. And I had challenged people to do it over their holiday weekend while, they had family around and lots of people. So my 15-year-old niece, Sierra, hey, Sierra, she goes to a performing arts school and she's a singer. And so I had talked to her before she got here and kind of gave her all the information and said, I'm going to leave it up to you. I want you to direct it and record it and decide you know, who's going to sing what and how you want to do it, but I want to get our video together over the holiday weekend. So she did do that quite effectively, I might add. And why don't we just give a listen to it?
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
I can hear my brother saying, I can't breathe. Now I'm in the struggle saying, I can't leave. Calling out the violence of these racist police. We ain't gonna stop till people are free.
We ain't gonna stop till people are free.
God, are we boys terrible.
I still hear my sister pleading, just trying to sleep. Now I'm in the struggle trying not to weep. Calling out the violence of this racist police. We ain't gonna stop till people are free. We ain't gonna stop till people are free.
I still hear my baby crying.
This guy's not real. Now I am in the struggle saying
we can't heal.
Calling out the violence of this racist police.
We ain't gonna stop till the people are free.
That's my mom.
We ain't gonna stop till the people are free.
Oh boy.
I still hear my neighbor saying, hands up, don't shoot me. Now I'm in the struggle with my heart on my sleeve. Calling out the violence of these racist police. And we ain't gonna stop till the people are free. And we ain't gonna stop till the people are free.
I can hear my brother saying, I can't breathe. Now I'm in the struggle saying, I can't leave. Calling out the violence of these racist bullies. And we ain't gonna stop till our people are free. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free. Hello. Well, my family decided over Christmas break to do a protest song showing how they feel about what's going on and showing that they can make a difference. So now I challenge you.
All right.
Yeah, so
did you guys catch the
messed up soul clap?
The soul clap fuck up by a very white guy.
By a very white guy.
No rhythm.
Yeah.
Shocking.
So Sierra, she produced it. She kind of arranged it, decided who was going to sing what. She did the recording, and she edited it with your help. And I was just really impressed. I thought she did a really great job. And it was great to see her kind of taking it so seriously and really getting into it. So what was the editing process? I wasn't here for a lot of that with you guys.
No, we just kind of picked, because we each did a recording of sort of the chorus, the intro part. So we cut those up a couple of times and then just had the various pieces. There wasn't a lot of editing. She just sort of made the decisions. But I said to her, and I'll say to you and all the listeners, she's a really good singer. I used to give her a bit of flack. In fact, I remember one time Mom was giving her some flack and said something like, oh, but, you know, you don't know how to sing. And she's like, well, that's your opinion. And I thought, wow, that's very mature of her. But with the school she's at, she's in tune. She's got she's finding her voice.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have thought of that for her so many years ago. She's not just the best singer in the family, but like, by a country mile.
Oh yeah, none of us can sing. We cannot sing. So it was great to do that with everybody and kind of have that whole experience with all of them.
It was awesome.
Yeah, it was a really good holiday. So
it was. So you know what time it is.
What you want to do? When the shirt on brown come for you.
Yes, all caps.
Yes, all cops. All right. So, yeah.
Yes,
all cops. This week's Yes, All Cops.
It's a big list.
It's a big list. It's just growing. But I could have done like six, but I just picked one, which comes out of Ferguson, yet again, because God forbid the Ferguson Police Department do anything that doesn't warrant being on this goddamn list. Ferguson officer gets unpaid leave after calling Mike Brown Memorial trash. Officer Timothy Zoll made the comments to the Washington Post Friday after a street memorial for Michael Brown was destroyed by a driver. A Ferguson, Missouri, police officer has been placed on unpaid leave after calling a memorial for Mike Brown trash, then misleading his superiors about the statement. Officer Timothy Zoll made the statements on Friday to the Washington Post when asked about the destruction of the improvised but long-standing memorial in the street where Mike Brown died. Quote, "I don't know that a crime has occurred," Zoll told the Post, "but a pile of trash in the middle of the street? The Washington Post is making a call over this," end quote. The department subsequently investigated the comment, and during the investigation, Zoll admitted, quote, that he misled his superiors when asked about the contents of the interview, end quote, according to a statement BuzzFeed News received Saturday from the city of Ferguson. Zoll has now been placed on unpaid leave while, quote, disciplinary proceedings begin. The statement added, it did not elaborate what might happen to Zoll or to the potential duration of the leave. The statement goes on to say that Zoll's remarks, quote, do not reflect the feelings of the Ferguson Police Department and are in direct contradiction to the efforts of the city officials to relocate the memorial to a more secure location, end quote. It also states that, quote, even after the officer's initial denial of his statement, the police chief continued the investigation until the truth was uncovered, end quote.
Yeah, I'm seeing how bullshit this whole, like, they don't accurately represent the Ferguson Police Department. Really? Because they're fucking hired and answering your phone and giving statements. Because if they don't represent, tell them to shut the fuck up.
Well, he was their public relations.
Oh, and he doesn't represent them? Get the fuck out of here.
He was their public relations person. And the funny thing about this, and it's not even actually funny, is that this man is on unpaid leave for making a statement about a memorial. But the person whose actions caused the memorial to be there in the first place.
Paid leave.
Paid leave.
Yep.
So.
And you know, the other thing that always kind of rubs me the wrong way is that it's never ever, oh, this is terrible. Let's take some action to address this and really educate our officers on the message we want to be delivering. It's just cut this one guy off and get rid of him. It's always a, oops, we got caught. It's never like, oh, we shouldn't have been doing that. It's like, ugh, you got this guy. We're going to have to hang him out to dry, you know, put him on unpaid leave. WAPO fucking recorded the conversation. Oops.
Oops. My bad.
And
yeah.
I don't want to spend all this time on Yes All Cops. I'll just say Yes All Cops turned their fucking backs during the funeral on de Blasio. You know who fucking protests at funerals?
Westboro Baptist Church.
That's right.
And the NYPD.
NYPD and Westboro. And you know what? This is Yes All Cops, but I did see, and I almost don't even want to mention it, there was a photo of one lone black police officer that did not turn around. And I hear that he's being reprimanded. They've kind of, other cops have doxed him and they're peer pressuring him into.
Yeah, he better watch himself. One word, Serpico.
Fuck. Fuck me. Yes, all cops.
Yes, all cops.
I hate that's a segment I hate to fucking do, but it just keeps growing and growing and growing.
Till I'm proven otherwise, we'll continue doing it.
You want to move on to something a little bit more positive?
Sure.
So I was tweeting with a few people about various things, and I don't know exactly how we got into the people's history, Howard Zinn's history textbook, but I love it. I know that was your high school textbook, which is, my God, what an amazing school to use the people's history as their
actual
textbook.
It wasn't just a school. I mean, the school hired the teacher that would do this, but I have to give a particular shout out to the great Jack Betterly, who educated hundreds and hundreds of amazing Emma Willard women with his unique brand of history. So
people history's textbook was Jack. It wasn't an Emma Willard.
It wasn't standard. You could take multiple American history classes, and you only got people's history through Jack's class.
Oh, thank God for Jack.
God bless him.
So I was actually, I don't know how it happened, but I guess the Zinn Project got tagged in something, and so they wrote back. And I had a bit of a dialogue and exchange with them, and I said, you know, hey, are people, you know, what are the metrics on your end? And they said that over 44,000 teachers have registered to access the lessons and teach the people's history outside of the sort of traditional history textbooks that are in the classroom. And I said, wow, that's, you know, kind of encouraging. And I said, what's the curve? And he said, it's increased. We're getting about 30 to 40 new teachers to register on a daily basis. And that's markedly up from maybe 3-4 months ago. So I don't know if that's a perfect data point, but it certainly was encouraging to me that teachers are becoming more aware and they're investigating how to be able to teach people's history in the classroom.
Well, I think that unfortunately, the way the textbooks are going, they're not going to have a choice. They're going to have to look for outside resources because these curriculums are fucking disgrace to education. Yeah. It's really disgusting.
Well, when you've got seven members of a school board in Texas that get elected with 200 or votes less making decisions on what textbooks to use, you know, good luck with that.
It's gross.
That's why we get intelligent design.
Mm. Yeah.
So did you hear about Rosie and Whoopi having a blow up?
Well, they've had a few, but I heard about one that had to do with, like, racism or something.
And I haven't even...
Let me just say, this Whoopi Goldberg's fucking crazy. Non for real.
Let's just start with Whoopi Goldberg was the person who was totally cool with Sam coming... Not Sam.
Ted Danson.
Ted Danson coming to her party in blackface.
Yeah, I wrote that bitch off then. I'm just telling you right now. Anybody who said anything about Whoopi Goldberg, like, yeah, y'all don't remember that her boyfriend came to her roast in blackface and she thought it was funny?
Yeah, she supported it. Yeah. Well, so I haven't even listened
because
to this.
Because comedy.
Well, but I will say that if it's funny, I give it a pass. But
nope.
I don't know if blackface is ever funny.
It ain't.
In fact, I have yet to seen a blackface anything that's even remotely funny.
It ain't funny.
So...
ain't funny. And you know what pisses me off the most about Whoopi Goldberg? Because this bitch went on a whole fucking tirade about how black people don't get this and black people don't get that in the industry and all this bullshit. She's the most hypocritical fucking crone out there. And I'll just have to, that's all I'll say about that. But let's listen to this bullshit that happened on The View.
And I have to be full disclosure, I haven't vetted this. I haven't listened to it myself either.
Oh, Jesus. So, I haven't heard it either.
Let's roll.
All right.
I just see it as stupid.
Do you all think that we live in a racist country?
Without a doubt.
Absolutely. Okay, see, I think a country that elects an African-American president twice, I don't think every American is racist.
And then the Congress that doesn't allow them to do one thing.
Right? And I think, but the Congress is controlled by Democrats.
Make that point again, because it's very important that people remember who was in the Congress.
Well, but the American people elect...
also, that we elected.
Right. Democrats are racist, you know? Too. It's well, our cultural
you know
history.
What? Listen, you are a white lady telling me what is racist to you.
You don't have to be black to know what racism is.
Yes, you do.
No, you don't.
Yes, you do,
no,
baby.
You do not.
Yes, you do.
Hmm.
Is she fucking kidding right now?
Who? Which one? Whoopi or Rosie?
Whoopi. You have to be black to know what racism is? Bish, please.
Yeah, I can usually smell racism pretty far away.
I mean, really?
And I'm as white as they come. I'm not anywhere near black, but I think I have a pretty good dial on what's racist.
You know what, though? That show irritates me. That's why I can't even be watching shit like that. Because you know why it irritates me? Because I'm not even trying to be out here caping for Rosie O'Donnell, but for real, she's the only one up there on that. They put her up there as this, like, bastion of liberal whatever. I don't even know what they intend her to be. She's the only one up there like, yeah, Bill Cosby raped those people. Yeah, that's racist. Yeah, this country's racist. Yeah, these cops are fucked up. That's her role there. The fact that they have to have somebody that has that role is ridiculous.
Yeah. You know, in fact, you had a good article. This might be a good lead-in about 10 ways friends can get blocked on Facebook.
Oh, yeah. Let's go over that shit.
I don't think one of them is a black person telling a white person that you don't know what racism is unless you're black. I don't know. Maybe you'll go to the 10. I'll see if one of Whoopi's complaints is on this list.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. Number one on the list. This is a list of dear white Facebook friends. 10 ways to get yourself blocked by a black person like me. Telling black people they are being divisive when they discuss racism.
Boy, I know you and I personally have heard that multiple times. You're doing it wrong.
Why do you have to talk about race?
I just wish we could love all people. You're being divisive.
Nah.
In fact, didn't you just have the...
All lives matter.
Wasn't there the one fight you had where the person was bitching about the rules for white people at protest?
And that was a troll, though. I was just fucking with that chick.
Yeah, but that was the same kind of like...
Yeah, but she wasn't my friend, though. She's just stupid. I like embarrassing her, that's all.
I think I remember you saying, like, why are you doing this? Because I'm fucking sitting on the couch bored.
Because I'm sitting on the couch, and it's not a great episode of The Wire, so I can do that today.
All right,
that's why.
Number two.
White people telling us to let them speak about black pain during our time of mourning.
I haven't heard this one. White people do this shit?
Yeah, apparently. There's an example. Terrell You are and have always been a close friend of mine. Why does this issue have to be an issue of black versus white? By doing so, you're advancing the divide rather than trying to bridge it. Regardless of what you think about the latest police issues nationwide, if there is a white person who is feeling your black pain, then let them join in the voice.
And that fucking, that statement got like six times by some people.
Yeah, some people. Yeah. I don't even know what to say. Right. Mm-hmm. Don't tell us we're spreading hate. A good friend told me that by December 5th status was the same as spreading hate. Well, no, it isn't. The fact that white people feel uncomfortable about the racism we say we talk about and experience is not because we're spreading hate. If anything, your discomfort is a small dose of what black people feel as we try to live our lives in racist institutions that deny our existence as human beings. If you don't want to learn why that is, you never really were our friend. And I have a particular person in mind when I read that.
Yeah. And I just, like, at what point is protesting the extrajudicial killing of black people, how is that more divisive than, you know, killing black people?
Right.
She's like, you're more upset about me being upset about shit than the actual shit that's upsetting me.
Yeah.
The fuck?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
That's what I got to say about that.
Number four, telling us to call white supremacy social injustice.
I refuse to equivocate. When people say that, I'm like, well, don't you think white people would take it better if you said this? I'm not here to make white people feel comfortable. That's not my job. Sorry. Right.
Okay, so parading your interracial relationship gets you no ally points with us. That's an interesting one. I noticed that during conversations about racism, many white men will try to leverage their "we're all human beings, let's stop making this a race issue" argument by saying that they have a black girlfriend so they understand what it is to be black in America. These same white, quote, allies tend to use pics with their black partners, their profile pic. I think your profile pic has me in it right now.
It does.
These same white men and women tend to believe dating black people gives them anthropological expertise in the psychology of being black.
I'll just say this. I date a real black woman, and she would never let me do some shit like that.
I know.
I would be reprimanded. I don't know what. You keep it real as fuck, and if I came across with any of that shit, it would never happen. And I will say that it's only today that I changed my Facebook.
Oh, I'm teasing about your Facebook.
And I put it on because it was the holiday one.
It was a holiday one. I like that one.
But most of the times, it's just me. In fact, on Twitter, it's just very white guy.
Just you. You voted for insert name of politician because he or she is black. That's number six. Doesn't even need to be that. You're being racist. Number seven seems pretty good.
You know what? That's crazy to me. In fact, I have to pull up my Vine for that from Blackish. Let's see here. Let me go to my profile. I wasn't quite ready here, but.
Ruby, that's racist.
Black people can't be racist.
There you go. Black people can't be racist.
Number eight, saying Mike Brown was a thug.
I blocked that instantly.
Yeah.
And in fact, I used to be like, just say the N-word. We know what you fucking mean.
Yeah.
Stop it.
Number nine, telling us our experiences with racism aren't real.
And is that the whole, like, race is a construct, or they don't believe?
Let's see what he says. He says, after a black person posts a status about how much racism they experience at the hands of white people, be it at work or by police, the worst thing any white person can do is reply that the person is being, quote, emotional or exaggerating the experience. Doing this suggests that black people lack the intellectual depth to appreciate or comprehend their experiences with racism. You're essentially ignoring your black friend's experience with race. Your best bet is to open your mind and listen to his experiences, not deny them. If you think hearing about his experiences with racism make you uncomfortable, imagine how it feels to actually experience them.
Yeah, and I mentioned this on the podcast at the very beginning. I did this, not did this, but so there was an incident at our health club where you'd indicated right after leaving, you said, you know, that felt kind of racially charged, something that was not quite right. And as my white male privilege, and I really do feel like white people have a reflexive muscle that we have trained through societal interactions and various socializations. We've trained this muscle as a reflex when we see and hear something. When you came to me and said, you know what, this felt kind of racial, knee-jerk, instantaneous, almost like a hot stove where your hand touches it and your hand pulls away without even thinking about it. Without even thinking about it, I was like, oh, I don't think that's what it meant. It probably wasn't like that. I've never experienced that. And it took me hearing you relay this to someone else to really kind of like, holy shit, did I just really disavow my actual black wife's experience with, like, I trust you implicitly. There's no one on earth that I trust anywhere near as much as I trust you. And here you are telling me that this was racially coded. And my first response was to, no, I don't think that. It probably didn't mean that. And it stunned me that that was my reaction. But I do think it's like a trained muscle, you know? And in fact, when that thing happened at church, when the person, I'm sick and tired of you talking about race, mainly racism. I know every single white person in there that had a reaction. They thought, oh my God, this is terrible. They went through those same steps.
Yeah.
He didn't mean it like that.
Right.
He probably didn't understand it.
No, I don't think, you know, the thing is about that situation that happened at church is that they were primed. So I don't think that they went through that, but they did go through the momentary, like, wow, this shit is even worse than we thought. I think they came into it thinking we have some deep down things to discuss. And it was like, nah, y'all are just fucking racist. And you got a lot of racists in here.
You prepped me for it, and it was still.
I told you before you left.
I said,
you need to steel yourself because you were going to hear some real fucked up shit when you go over there and try and talk about this. I'm telling you right now.
It was still such a kick in the nuts that I was like, I don't say stunned into silence, but I didn't even know how to formulate my thoughts. I ended up having to leave.
Right? Yeah.
I just was like, ugh, what the fuck? I can't, you know, this is crazy. And the thing that really, and I'm not trying to like besmirch folks at our church community. I do love them and they're great and they're doing the work. It's hard work and it's needed. And I applaud them for doing the work. I'm talking like, you know, watching Mirrors of Privilege, having, you know, racial, experts come in and talk about all of these things in groups of 50, 60 people or more. So I do applaud them. But at that follow-up meeting, it was like so many of the white people were like literally in tears, like crying in tears because they felt that they had let me and you and us down by not standing up. And I was like,
oh. Well, they did.
I understand, but that's not something to cry about. Just
well, I think it is
better
for them because you know what it is, and this is something that I have found with white people, is that they are you all are hardwired to consistently think of yourself as good people. And this is where the pushback comes with regard to racism, is because anything that pushes back on that notion, you can't handle it. Your entire being has been set up. Your whole life has been set up from the time you're born all the way through your death is to surround yourself with situations and things that make you feel like you're a good person.
Well, in fact, there's a great article, and make sure we post it on the notes here. Make a note for me. White fragility. I've shared it a couple times. Some people really, really appreciate it. I've found a lot of value and depth in this sort of just analysis of white fragility. And it's exactly what you're describing, that we have, as white people, cultivated this space, this bubble, you know, that just kind of, we got to burst it.
Yeah. Pop. So, Pope Francis was out it again, living that thug Pope life, man.
You know, what's the opposite of lame duck blackness?
Oh,
that's what
no.
the Pope does.
He's
like
fucking
first term
white hat popeness or something. I don't know. He ain't playing.
I mean, he came out right away with the marriage equality. He came out with a bunch of statements. But
now he got this whole climate change shit he about to work on. This Pope ain't playing. But anyways, he put out 10 tips for a happier life from Pope Francis.
Let's hear it.
Okay, number one. Live and let live. Everyone should be guided by this principle, he said, which has a similar expression in Rome with the saying, move forward and let others do the same. You know what that is?
Worry about yourself. Worry about yourself.
Exactly. Apparently, the Pope's watched that video as well. Number two, be giving of others, of yourself to others. Be giving of yourself to others. People need to be open and generous towards each other, he said, because if you withdraw into yourself, you run the risk of becoming egocentric and stagnant water becomes putrid, end quote.
He is not equivocating.
Oh, he sure ain't.
I like that.
Number three, proceed calmly in life. The Pope, who used to teach high school literature, used an image from an Argentine novel by Ricardo Garaldes, in which the protagonist, Gaucho Don Segundo Sombra, looks back on how he lived his life. Proceed calmly. Number four, a healthy sense of leisure. The Pope said, quote, consumerism has brought anxiety, and told parents to set aside time to play with their children and turn off the TV when they sit down to eat.
And, you know, that was the there was the study. I don't know who did it, but it came out sometime this year, where people that that self-report that they're more interested in things are less happier than people that self-report that they're more interested in experiences.
Right.
So if you crave the next iPhone 6 versus you crave your next vacation, the person craving vacation is generally reporting that they're happier.
Happier, yeah. That makes sense.
Sure does.
Number 5, Sundays should be holidays. Now, I find this one interesting because he says, workers should have off Sundays because Sunday is for the family, not for the church. He says, Sunday is for the family, he says. Interesting from a Pope.
Yeah.
Number 6, find innovative ways to create dignified jobs for young people. Quote, we need to be creative with young people. If they have no opportunities, they will get into drugs and be more vulnerable to suicide, he says. Interesting.
I'm not sure how finding innovative ways for better jobs for young people would make me happier, but okay.
Yeah.
I see the benefit.
Yeah.
I don't see that making me happier.
No, but it's a happier life, generally speaking, yeah, okay. I guess. Number 7, respect and take care of nature. He goes with his environmental. Environmental degradation, quote, is one of the biggest challenges we have, he said. I think a question that we're not asking ourselves is it humanity committing suicide with this indiscriminate and tyrannical use of nature, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard a Pope speak about environment at all.
No.
Not in such specific terms. This is great. Number 8, stop being negative. Quote, needing to talk badly about others indicates low self-esteem. That means I feel so low that instead of picking myself up, I have to cut others down, the Pope said. Letting go of negative things quickly is healthy. Take that, trolls.
And I'd even say just to friends and people that are listening, and I don't know why, but on Facebook and other even on Twitter, I'll post something like, oh, I really love this, and I really loved Annie. And right away, it's like, I didn't like it. What the fuck?
Keep that shit to yourself.
I put into the ethos.
You probably want to hear what you hated.
I liked this thing, and your inclination is that I think I want to hear that you didn't like it. Get the fuck out of here.
Did I ask you what you thought?
It's always
did
right
it say,
away.
I like this. What did you guys think? No, I didn't say that, bitch. No. I said, I liked fucking Annie.
Yeah. First response, I hated it. Okay.
Block. Number 9, don't proselytize. Respect others' beliefs. Again, this is from a Catholic Pope.
You sure you're reading that right?
Oh, I'm reading it right. He says, quote, we can inspire others through witness so that one grows together in communicating. But the worst thing of all is religious proselytism, which paralyzes. Quote, I'm talking with you in order to persuade you. No. Each person dialogues, starting with his and her own identity. The church grows by attraction, not proselytizing, says the Pope.
Interesting. He should tell the evangelical born-again Jehovah's.
Oh, he already went off on them. You didn't hear. That was his last white hat popeness. The other day he said he was in India or somewhere. I don't know where he was. Somewhere in the Middle East, though. And he said he was saying that people should not be denouncing Islam because of terrorism, because we all have our extremists.
Wow. I saw a couple of ancillary comments to that. I didn't know the original quote.
Yes.
That's great.
Because,
you know, in fact, I do think the U.S. government listed as extremist groups multiple, like, religious fringe, like, you know, First Amendment, Second Amendment, guns, 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 and God. Yeah, here's a picture of me with my gun and my Bible and a bald eagle.
And number 10, of course, work for peace. We are living in a time of many wars, he says, and the call for peace must be shouted. Peace sometimes gives the impression of being quiet, but it is never quiet. Peace is always proactive and dynamic, says our Pope.
I really like that last one. I would say that, you know, we talked at the beginning, that I haven't felt this balance. I'm doing, you know, a little too much, this or that. That said, whenever I'm doing anything, regardless of what it is within the social justice work, within the movement, I feel, I don't know. I don't say better, happier, more fulfilled. I feel more fulfilled than, you know. In fact, that's one of the problems I'm having, is that the fulfilling nature of that work really makes, like, making money at my day job kind of, I don't say drudgery, but it's just different.
It's different. It's just different.
I don't enjoy my day job, because I still do. I like the work. I like the people. I like the stuff. But it has a different... there's a different motivation to it now that I have an outlet for feeling fulfilled. And in fact, I've been saying that a little bit about work for a while, just hadn't really felt very fulfilled. But I think this social justice work, and I would say working for peace, is a very fulfilling, very rewarding work.
Yeah. So tip of the hat.
That was a really great list.
To the pontiff.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead, Pope Francis. Very, very bad self. So everybody knows that I'm a huge fan of Tamar Braxton. Love her, everything about her. I really identify with her, you know, because she's the youngest sister in a family of sisters, which I am as well. And, you know, being the youngest and the spoiled one and all of that has its own, shall we say, unique challenges.
Yeah, you're definitely a Tamar. I'm a Tawanda.
Mm-hmm. So I appreciate her. So she has, well, I also appreciate the fact that that bitch is on her grind.
Who, Tamar?
Oh yes. She is faithfully not playing.
Vince?
Vince is her husband, yes.
The show, her
Vince
album.
And Herbert. She's on the Braxton show. She got her own show. She got a talk show she's on now, The Real, which has been doing very well ratings-wise. She has a line of clothing now. She has a line of vodka. She had, she was nominated for 2 Grammys last year. She had a platinum-selling album and a new one that's coming out. I mean, she's doing the most.
She had a baby?
She had, oh yes. And in the midst of all of that, she had a baby. So, yeah. Shout out to Tamar. Go ahead, Tamar. But we were watching an episode of Tamar and Vince, which is their show that's her solo show.
The spinoff
of the
Braxton family.
Yeah, the spinoff of the Braxton family. And on her show, The Real, they had a woman who was terminally ill. She had a brain tumor. And she was part of the Make-A-Wish Foundation. And she had said that her wish was to meet and spend some time with Tamar Braxton. And Tamar was really, I would say, appropriately both, you know, moved, because of course, if somebody asks you that, you want to be there and be present and participate, but also was appropriately kind of stunned. Like, why in the world would you could do anything and meet anybody? Why would you want to meet me? Like,
I remember when they started talking about it, that was my knee jerk. I was like, Tamar, like, that's your dying wish? Like,
right.
And I got to give her credit right away. She said the same thing. Like,
she did.
Me.
She was like, I don't know. I don't want to do anything wrong. And I don't want to, you know, I want to make sure that it's good for her. And the person that was, you know, kind of, spearheading the meeting, and the girl got to come onto the Real, and she did a segment on the talk show and everything. It was really beautiful. Said that the woman is a really happy person, and has a very positive outlook despite this, you know, this diagnosis that she's going to be, you know, she's in the midst of dying. And so, you know, just feed off of her energy was kind of her advice to Tamar. And it was really, it really was moving. I mean, I don't know about you, but I was really moved by the entire piece and the whole, the way that it all played out. And so Tamar had, when she got her very first check of any money she started making when she first got a deal or whatever, she got her check and she went out, not that it was the whole check, but when she first got her first chunk of change, she bought this Chanel purse, and she'd kept this Chanel purse for like 15 years. This old Chanel purse that she had bought. It was sentimental and it was something to her, and she decided to give it to the woman as a gift. And she was like, I don't know, it's not a new purse or anything, but it meant a lot to me, and I wanted to give her something that meant something to me, not just something that was monetarily worth money. I wanted to give her something that meant something to me. If she wanted to meet me, this was a piece of me I wanted to give to her. And I was really moved by it.
And you're even almost underselling it. She was talking with her, I guess, assistant or producer that was kind of managing this interaction and part of the show. And she said, well, I got her something. I don't know. I'm thinking maybe I shouldn't show it. Maybe I shouldn't. I don't think it's appropriate. She goes, what is it? Show me. She had it like wrapped in tissue and all really well presented. And she pulls out, and it's an antique, was it Coach? What was the
Chanel?
Chanel's antique Chanel bag. It's not the most expensive one. It's probably not even that in style that much. But it's clear that it was when she had money, her first check, that's what she went out and got.
Yep. You know,
this is my first splurge. And for her to give it to somebody and the reaction right
to give
away,
it to her, to give it to somebody because she had saved it all this time. So it was so clear how much it meant to her, you know, that she had moved it around from state to state and had kept it in this condition for so long. It meant a lot to her, and that she went and pulled it out and thought to do it. I thought it was really, I mean, even the assistant just was like, oh my God.
The assistant was like bursting into tears. Like, are you kidding me? You have to give that to her.
Yeah.
That's so thoughtful.
And then when she did give it to her, I mean, it was a really beautiful moment. And they did a really good job. But it got us to thinking,
Yeah, and I just start out, shout out Tamar, way to go.
Yeah.
That was a
bravo, Tamar.
I hate to say it was a classy move.
It was. Well, no. You can use the word classy about other people. My rule is if you call yourself classy, you're not classy.
That was classy as shit, Tamar.
Yeah, it was very classy.
So it did get us, and in fact, the dialogue was, well, like, if you're dying and you want to meet somebody, there's like a... Do you aim real high? Like, do you shoot for, like, the Pope, President Barack Obama, knowing that maybe your wish might not get fulfilled?
Right.
Or do you, like, aim a little bit lower, like mid-level, thinking, like, well, let me go, like, B instead of A and see if the B, you know, celebrities will – B-list celebrities will be more willing to take my request.
Right.
So given that, where on the A, B, C, D, and who would you pick – thinking you only get one chance, you don't get to ask multiple people.
Right. So these are the rules you're setting up.
Yeah. You can only ask once, and you want to ask at the level of celebrity that you think will respond. Yeah. And so where are you at?
You know, it's funny. I would have, prior to like the last 6 months, picked a whole bunch of people that I can't stand now.
Really? Celebrities?
Yeah, celebrities.
You're talking like the Jill Scott,
Oprah, all of these people. Okay. So I kind of actually think I would go like in a whole different direction. Like I'd want to meet like, and I don't even know if they're B or C, but the first person that I thought of was Melissa Harris Perry.
I think that'd be
because I feel like it would be doable. I feel like she would probably be open to it, and also I think it would be a really great conversation. So that's where I kind of went with it in terms of, you know, all of that. Plus, I have met Oprah, so you know,
there's that. Yeah. So I was thinking sort of the same thing. Like, what would I do? Which way would I go? And I thought a little differently. I was thinking like, if I was dying, maybe I'd want to like laugh. Like I want to like.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Have somebody that would like do like a little comedy routine for me. And I was thinking like, who would be really. Like, who's just generally funny, like, period, but isn't so big that they wouldn't be able to come, like Kevin Hart would be like, nah, you know, I'm from Philly, but, you know, fuck that dude. I'm not going to go meet him, right? So I was thinking maybe J.B. Smoove. he really kind of cracks me up.
I would have picked Tracy Morgan.
Yeah, but Tracy,
I don't know if he's is up to that sort of thing, but yeah. He's one of those people that his voice makes me laugh.
Ooh, Paul Mooney.
Paul Mooney would be like, fuck you.
Well, he would write something about dismissing me because I'm white that would make me fucking laugh like shit. So that
Paul
that might
Mooney
go Paul
would
Mooney.
Be great. He is so fucking hilarious.
That was one of the I was talking with Ricky. I mean, it was Ricky. No, I don't want to spoil it. But I was talking with somebody about a survey, like how like are you racist or not? Like a not quite an implicit bias, but similar.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things we came up with: do you think Paul Mooney's funny? That's just one of the like.
I think that's just like a rule of like if you can hang out with me or not. Like if you don't think Paul Mooney's funny, I just don't know if I trust you.
Yeah, if you think Paul Mooney's like racially inappropriate and not funny and insensitive, then you just have no, you know, I don't know what, no yeah. lens at all.
That None.
Is, that's the part that we said in the beginning. If it's funny, it's okay. Mooney's always fucking funny.
Yeah, but the thing is, he's funny and he's meant as satire. Like, my thing is, like, people don't understand the idea of comedy as satire being funny, not just being gratuitously outrageous. He's not gratuitously outrageous at all. He's making a statement through his comedy that's very relevant. It's jarring, it is, but it's true.
Yeah.
So that's what's funny about it. It's like people don't even get it. It's like his whole thing about Tom Cruise is the last samurai. It's funny because it's fucking true. As we see with Exodus, the big flop that won't even be shown in most Middle Eastern countries.
Yeah.
Including Egypt with his bandit.
That's great.
Anyways, yeah. So that's who you'd pick. Paul Mooney's a good choice. Good choice, babe.
Thank you. Hey, did you... I know you heard about it, because how could you not have heard about it? But I ran up on it in real time. The Christmas Day Temecula Showdown.
I don't know if we have Temecula time, babe.
Oh, no. We can't talk about my tweets real as fuck?
We might have to wait on that. We're in an hour already.
All right. We'll shelve it, but... Folks, do yourself a favor. go listen to TBGB, The Black Guy Who Tips.
Yeah, please.
Or
you have to be premium to do the Balls Deep Sports. He did it the last two episodes as well. So for sure, listen to the last two episodes of Black Guy Who Tips, because Rod and Karen go in on it. It's hilarious.
And my tweet's real AF. If you're one of our subscribers, no shade, bro.
Yeah, do not meet us anywhere.
I do not want to meet you anywhere.
Nope.
I can see by your Avi picture you would definitely kick my ass.
Yeah.
Not gonna pick
and
that
and your rapping style, so there's that.
Yeah.
Because he has a song out now.
Well, I do want to talk about it because you kind of know the other guy on the side of the
screen.
Well,
I wouldn't say I know him, but I had already followed him. And I was like, wait a second, you talking about Snotty Drippin? And you were like, wait, well, how do you know him? I'm like, we follow each other on Twitter. It's kind of funny. All right, we'll talk about some other
time. Another time.
Another time.
You want to talk about unboxing poop?
Yeah, more unboxing poop because we already talked about unboxing poop before, which if anybody remembers, we did a whole piece about Cards Against Humanity who this Black Friday sold a box of cow shit to people for $6, literal cow shit. And so they started arriving and people started making videos of them unboxing said poop. We played one video, which was pretty hilarious. And then we went to see our friends, Scott and Kristen. Shout out to them. What's up, Scott and Kristen?
Delaware.
And got into the hole that is all of the unboxing poop videos.
We went down a YouTube spiral.
Lord Jesus.
Of unboxing. So he thought the podcast was, they hadn't really listened to it. So we listened to it and it was funny. He's like, well, unboxing poop, let's see the actual video because you can't see it on the podcast.
Right.
So we watched it and he's like, well, there's more. I said, oh, this is, you know, when we did this was kind of new. It was like short after Black Friday when the poop had just arrived.
Right.
So now there's more unboxing
more
poop.
More and more.
And would I be wrong in saying we must have watched like 30?
At least.
20?
Yeah.
First of all,
it was a good hour.
There was only 18,000 of these boxes of poop sold.
Yeah, and
right?
They all, and some.
Or 30,000.
I think they all made a fucking video. Every one of them.
Well, and
we noticed immediately.
Oh, yeah.
Some common threads.
What were some you saw?
Well, first of all, they know how to work their fucking cameras.
Oh, you mean like not focusing on the poop?
Yeah, they couldn't focus on anything. They're like, this is what it is. They'd hold it up and it would be like completely out of focus, like, or not even in the frame of the picture. Good job, dude.
There was the one guy who, first of all the hair, like every other dude had greasy long hair.
First of all, they're all completely like 100% nerds.
All white dudes.
Almost all of them lived in their mom's basement.
Totally.
But
with the one you're talking about, the unfocused camera, one guy unboxed the poop with the camera like it was his iMac that was focused on him.
Ridiculous.
Like it wasn't even showing the box
of
poop.
Couldn't even see the poop.
It was him with like a headset and like a yarmulke, or you know, he's like, what? Where's the poop? The product's not even in your video.
Yeah.
Stylistically,
and then
that's not good.
The decor, they all had like weird posters on their walls from like Dungeons and Dragons.
Posters? What the fucking Dirty Laundry?
Oh, yeah, Dirty Laundry, boxes of pizza.
Have eaten sandwiches.
Just ridiculous.
And there was at least two that were straight up in mom's basement. Like
oh,
ironing
definitely.
Board,
not
and
just
washing
two,
machine.
Like multiple. Multiple.
How about did you catch the names of some of these folks?
Yeah, my favorite one was Stony Gay.
Was it Sony Gay or Sony Gay?
Oh, no, it was Gay, like G-A-Y.
There was Nintendo Freak, Attack Slug.
Lord Omax.
Lord Omax was the guy that had the camera pointed at himself the whole time.
Ridiculous.
Show the poop, Lord Omax. Come on.
They all had some variation. It was like, oh, this is just poop.
Yeah. The one guy said, this is not as cool as I had hoped.
Well, they told you it was going to be shit.
Like, what did you think? And what about this? So, and I didn't know, but I've learned about the game Cards for Humanity.
Yeah.
And it's Kickstarter. Each and every fucking one of these dudes was convinced there was a card somewhere in the poop.
Yeah.
And even despite the fact that the website said,
all you're getting is bullshit. Poop.
And if you think that you're buying something other than bullshit, you have learned a valuable $6 life lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And you put it on YouTube.
Well, they learned it. Yeah. Every day. Oh, we're like, there's a card here somewhere ripping apart the bottom of the box, breaking apart the poop.
What about the one guy, and I swear this is verbatim, I hope this poop unboxing video makes my friends like me more.
End quote.
Ooh, is that sad.
Very.
You spent $6 on poop and then recorded it in the hopes that your six friends would like you more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to work out that way, buddy.
One interesting thing that I thought just randomly, almost all of them had a sword-shaped letter opener.
A lot of knives.
I don't know why that. I didn't know that was a big thing in the nerd community, but apparently, and I went online because I was going to order one for Scott because I was laughing so
no,
hard
you
about
weren't.
It. I was. And the one the one that they all had was a very specific one. It was a Game of Thrones sword letter opener.
Oh, see, I was thinking Lord of the Rings.
Game oh, no. It was a Game of Thrones. I looked. I was like, oh, that's the one right there because it was very obvious. Yeah, and they all had it. It was like, it would come up and we'd all go, sword letter opener.
I really don't advise our listeners to go watch unboxing poop, but hilarious.
The final thing I'll mention is that most of them were smart enough when they showed like the outside of the box to block off their address. But I'm going to talk to you, Sean O'Keefe, who lives at 245 Harbinger Ridge Road in Harbinger, North Carolina, 27941-9752. Next time you do a video, Sean, block out your goddamn address because you're an idiot.
He didn't just block out his address. He like showed it like center focus.
Center focus zoomed in on it. Literally, we didn't even have to pause it for me to write all of that down.
I almost want to like buy more poop and just send it to Sean.
Send it to Sean. We should send him something. We will. Let's send him something.
Maybe the Johnners could recommend.
Let's totally send. Yeah. Tweet us what we should send to Sean. Just the hashtag send to Sean and we'll send it to him and maybe we'll have him on the show. He can tell us what he thought about what we sent.
And not anything cruel. We don't have to be mean.
No, anymore. No. Just something funny because he, you know, he put his address out.
Like,
maybe, especially because he lives, this was the recent video, so we know he lives there now.
It could be a little bit, I don't want to say cruel, but maybe like a really big dildo.
No dildos. We're not sending anybody dildos.
No?
That's sexual harassment.
All right, okay.
We can send him a cock keychain. Just kidding.
A pocket pussy?
No, we're not sending him that either.
He might use it.
My mother listens to this podcast.
Oh, sorry, Mom.
Okay, so we had another discussion.
Well, in fact, before you get to that, the last thing I was saying, I didn't know this, but I read a blog about Cards Against Humanity that it's, although maybe fun to play once or twice, it gets really old after a while.
Right.
And the person was indicating that the thing that got old was the sort of cis, hetero, white, male privilege inherent in the game. And the example, they had a few examples, but so there's a card that's got a blank space, like, you know, what do you think about blah? Mm-hmm. And then you have another card that's got answers and you're supposed
to it's like Mad Libs.
Yeah, and whoever has the best answer wins.
Right.
So the one card was big black cock. And I was like, why is that big black? I guess is black cock funnier than white cock?
That's what the card was?
Yeah, so the answer.
Oh, the answer. Right, was, got it. But the fill in.
What would you put in Susie's mouth? Big black cock. Right?
So that's they don't ask questions like that. It's more like a blank statement.
Well, but what would you know, I put blank in Susie's mouth.
Right.
Big black cock would be the funny answer. So a subsequent set of cards had bigger, blacker cock. And so the author was sort of saying, you know what? This just kind of seems like really, you know, frat boy, white, cis, hetero male. And it got old after, you know, so many.
Yeah, but iterations. The thing is, you can make your own cards. So I don't really follow that.
You can make your own cards?
Yeah, they have it for free right on the website. You can print them out and everything.
All right, blogger,
You can make your own fucking cards.
Make your own tiny white penis.
Yeah. Whatever you want. I don't buy that.
Well, maybe the comment was the ones that they're printing and producing.
Sure, but hey, who the fuck else is going to sit around playing cards except for frat boys? They're playing to their audience, but they give you a mechanism to make whatever card you want to. I mean, that's crazy.
Fair enough.
Let's not bring things into where they really don't belong. These dudes are just making a buck, and they built a good, strong company that's employing people. And I don't think that that's a fair thing to throw at them.
And sending poop in the mail.
And teaching people a fucking lesson about capitalism.
Well done. So you
and buying some cows for people in the process.
When I was coming home from the train with Junie, I had.
That's my brother-in-law.
Yes. I had the throwback jams.
Backspin.
Backspin on SiriusXM.
Yeah.
And on came a song. And I said, oh, my God, that is like the fucking white people's like rap anthem.
Right.
Like, when that comes on, white people are like, oh, my God.
Oh, my God, that's my jam.
Cue that up for me.
What song is that? Oh, the one you said?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, here we go. But it's on the list.
I understand, but just play. Yeah. White people, white people, white people, white people, white people, white people.
Pack it up, pack it in, let me begin. Pack in the window.
That's enough.
That's so much enough. But the video is so fucking ridiculous. It's like all Boston, Irish, crazy, drunk.
He's white. He's got an Irish Celtics hat on.
He's got a Celtics jersey on. There's bagpipes being played. There's buttons that say, kiss me, I'm Irish. They got those guys in those funny hats. And we're white.
I remember it as being sort of
jump around.
You know, those other, and so we started talking about it, and we together said, "Well, what are the top 10 songs white people love, rap songs.
Rap songs, right.
And I have to give you credit. You pinged number one. And House of Pain, Jabber On was number two.
All right, so let's go through all of them.
No, right.
Number 10 was the one I chose to actually play. So number 10, here we go. Hey, yo, sweetie, you looking kind of
pretty. What's a girl like you doing? I got him, man.
Like how that sounds. What you say, we get to know each other better. That sounds good, but I don't think I can let you. I don't know, tell me, is it so? Do you get a kick out of telling brothers no? No, it's not that, so you don't understand. I said I'll put it. I got a man. What your man got to do with me? I told ya. I'm not trying to get up, see. I'm not one of those girls that go ripping around. I'm not a dumb baby. So don't play me like a clown. This song is one long, 3.5 minute lesson in street harassment. Just to be clear, she said she got a fucking man. How about you step off and stop trying to talk to her?
I'm just saying hi, Positive K. What the fuck?
Fuck you, Positive K. Number 9. All you gotta do is give Humpty a chance. Now I'm gonna do my dance. The Humpty dance.
Yeah, we love that. Maybe I shouldn't speak for all white people, but
yeah.
This very white guy loves the Humpty dance.
Yeah.
I could sing that shit right now.
I'm going to read a couple of the things that go along with this. It says the top 10 rap songs white people love, and I mean fucking love. When these when these songs come on, white people look at each other and say, "Oh yeah," or "Hell yeah," and are compelled to sing along. Sometimes there's a corresponding stupid dance move. Having studied white people for 30 years, my authority on the topic is absolute. This list is damn near bulletproof. Number 10, Positive K, I've Got a Man, white people's most beloved rap duet. White girls in particular love this song because it gives them a chance to playfully reject a male suitor's advances on the dance floor before blowing him at the end of the night. It's empowering.
In the stall in the club.
That's right.
In the bathroom.
Number 9, Digital Underground, Humpty Dance. The Humpty Hump was rap music's greatest alter ego and actually a good MC, but all white people know and love him for is I Like My Oatmeal Lumpty and Burger King Bathroom. Fucking white people.
Yep.
Number 8, Biz Markie, Just a Friend. Oh my God, do white people love this song, particularly frat boys. Why? I don't know.
I can tell you because it's out of tune. He sings terribly.
Mm. Unlike most of his peers on this list, the Biz is a guy long deep in the hip-hop scene with lots of cred. Yet to white people, he'll only be that fat, funny-looking black guy with the wig who sings bad. Number 7. The wackest of whack. Young MC, Bust a Move. I believe there's a law that requires this song be played at every rock and bowl. Like that the police shut down the bowling alley, it doesn't comply. Okay. That they don't play it, then the police shut it down.
Well, that was the one when we were naming our list before.
Oh, yeah, I said that one for sure.
And I said, I couldn't remember the name of it. I said, what's that one from The Wedding Singer where the old lady raps?
Exactly.
That one.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Number 6, Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock.
It takes two. You can honestly, there's a couple of them, like that, what's the first one you just played? The fucking Irish rappers, House of Pain, that first bar, I mean, seriously, at a wedding, whatever it is, white people jump up. That's my shit.
Yeah.
And same with this one. You hear that first fucking, like, two bars,
yeah.
It's like, oh, my God.
Knowing the words to I Get Stupid, I Mean Outrageous, is standard and unremarkable. Knowing everything up through the hook means you'll be Frenching at 80s night. Number 5, Naughty by Nature, Hip Hop Hooray. No.
Yeah, and that's got the hand movements. And mm-hmm. In fact, when I was in college, there was a club that was one of these, like, you could get in at 19 and they put an X on your hand and you weren't supposed to drink, but you can go, like, wash it off and shit.
Yeah.
And I swear, they didn't have a DJ. They had, like, a CD and it was, like, fucking clockwork. Like, 11:45, that shit would come on. Like, oh, close to midnight. They're playing OPP or Hip Hop Hooray. They're playing fucking.
That's right. It says, before he was shooting porn and marrying / divorcing Peppa, Tretch was teaching white people the world over how to wave their hands from side to side above their heads while singing nursery rhymes.
Mm.
Number 4, Whoop, There It Is by Tag Team. Man, what was the fucking story about this song and the other one that came out at exactly the same time by, I believe, 95 South called Woot, There It Is? somebody fucked somebody else over big time here. The weird thing about this song, ubiquitous and beloved by Wisconsin grandmothers, that is that its lyrics contain the words motherfucking, nigga, and shit, and references to smoking dank. Crazy. I remember watching the Box Video Network, where I learned everything I know about black people, and seeing Tag Team's follow-up to this one, Woomp, C. Lois, and Adam's Family Woomp. I'm not kidding.
Adam's Family Womp?
Yeah, we have to play that
one. They milked that shit, man.
Oh, shit.
And I wouldn't say that this is white people's favorite rap song. I wouldn't have put this as high, but fucking stadiums, dude. Arenas, like arenas. Basketballs and shit. Oh, my God. Comes out every time.
Yeah. Of course, at number three, his iciness himself, Vanilla Ice. Ice, Ice Baby, Mr. Rob Van Winkle. This song is on the list that white people pretend to only like ironically. Don't be fooled. Deep down, white people still think Ice is 100% gangsta. I remember back in the day battling another sixth grader at the ice skating rink, and who could rap the first verse of this song the fastest? The kid was Asian, so I won.
And I don't want to say that I, as a white person, take exception with this being on the list, this high on the list. It was definitely that popular at the time. And because it was so popular, it has a little bit of a, I don't call it like nostalgic, and it's Under Pressure. It's a good bass line, right? So when you hear, it kind of, there's a little bit of an emotion like, hey, all right. You know? And you do kind of like, with my hair on my rack top down flow or whatever the, you know.
I sing this song all the time. It just personally for me, it's a very nostalgic and it reminds me of high school. So I'm like, you know. Cool. And the dance was funny, too.
Although what's sad now is that he still has money and MC doesn't. MC Hammer's kind of broke.
Well, you know, that's what happens when you invest in real estate versus give your money away to people that don't have any business getting money.
Or have an entourage 200 deep.
That's what I'm saying. Give your money away to people that don't have no business getting your money. Or you can invest in real estate, one of the two.
So number two was
House of Pain. White people will never be completely comfortable with black music, so anytime they're given the opportunity to like a song by one of their own race, they go fucking overboard. If you've ever seen black people comedy, you'll be familiar with the notion that white people have no rhythm and can't dance. This is true. That's why they will embrace both honky arms, any song that makes it okay for them to not actually dance during it, or that tells them exactly what to do and when to do it. If you go to a club and this fucking song comes on, all the white people will literally jump around. Yeah. I fucking promise you.
And it's funny, as a rhythmically challenged white guy, I seek out songs like that, like Lean Back, like, oh, I'm on all day. Lean back. I could do that. That's a fucking dance right there. I'm on that.
Yeah, that's a good one. Number one, which I called, is, of course, Becky, Look at Her Butt by Sir Mix-a-Lot, Baby Got Back. Go to a karaoke bar. Get the song list. Check the rap section. There's only one song. This is the song. Every fucking time. This is the song. This, like a number of other rap songs white people love, features prominently sexual themes addressed in a humorous fashion. I think it's white people's inherent prudish squareness that makes them get all giddy about naughty rapper songs.
And I don't know if you know, do you know his attempt at a... so he had My Hoopty was kind of... My Hoopty rolling.
I think My Hoopty was before Baby Got Back, though.
He don't work and the bitch be nagging. So, but his other attempted sort of follow-up to Baby Got Back, do you remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Put him on the glass.
Oh, God.
It was so bad.
So bad.
And it was about, like, I guess chicks putting their titties on the glass in a shower. And that was the whole video, like blurred out titties on the glass.
Awesome.
And that was the, put them on the glass. Like, really? That you could have tried a little harder than that.
Mm-hmm. There's some honorable mentions.
Ooh.
Let's go through those. Two Live Crew, Me So Horny. Too Dirty for Old White People. A significant portion of all white people to make the list. But man, how times have changed. Remember the reactions when it came out? Florida was ready to lynch Uncle Luke. Today, he's Jeb Bush's golfing buddy.
He's like a peewee football, like, it's true. Entrepreneur coach guy.
Go, shorty. It's your birthday. 50 Cent in the club. 50!
That's a hot beat, though. I don't blame white people.
Everybody loves that song.
That's a fucking hot. Yeah. Oprah liked that song. Yeah, exactly.
Arrested Development, Everyday People, and Tennessee. People Every Day. Tennessee has become more famous, has a more famous name, but it's not the one that 15 years later is still being played every night in every club in Ecuador and probably other countries, too. Ditto Madonna's Like a Prayer, but that's a whole different list. The Beastie Boys, Brass Monkey, The Funky Monkey, and You Gotta Fight for Your Right to Party. White people collectively love all three. Oh, and the other one is Girls. Collectively love all three of these songs, but not individually enough to crack the top 10. Of course, are you could get with this or you could get with that. Black Sheep, not quite famous enough to make the list, but man, is it ever fun to say you could get with this or you can get with that 100 times in 3 minutes. Juvenile, Back That Ass Up. As you can see, it's basically impossible for white people to truly love your rap song if it's less than a decade old. Still, Juvenile got close with this one, which features a verse from a significantly littler Wayne. Lil Jon and the East Side Boys, Get Low.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Nelly, Hot In, So Hot In Her. Again, with the whites getting titillated by suggestive lyrics, Nelly is the white Justin Timberlake. That's the funniest shit I've ever heard. Let me repeat that again. Nelly is the white Justin Timberlake. What does that mean?
Somebody ought to tell him about his school.
Mm-hmm.
What was the name of his school?
Extreme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if Extreme Institute's producing the next hot year.
I love it when you call me Big Papa. You know, because white people can be 350-pound black gangster Romeos, too. Actually, by definition, they cannot. Puff Daddy, It's All About the Benjamins, Baby. Diddy, Salt and Pepper, Push It. This and Let's Talk About Sex ruled the roller rinks back in the day, but neither could get these gals into the top 10. Still, much respect to the pair, or triumvirate if you count Spinderella's butt, for being the women that got the closest. The next one, I'm surprised because it was on my, would have been on my list, which is Tone Loc's Wild Thing, or Funky Cole Medina, whichever one. Wild Thing gets a nod since the only words 99% of people know to Funky Cole Medina are Funky Cole Medina. So that's why Wild Thing got it. Tupac, California Love. Had to have a Tupac song on the list. I think white people love Pac because he makes them feel like they've lost a friend to gang violence.
Well, you know, it's funny that, in fact, we were talking about people loving the digital underground and Hoopty. They don't even know that Tupac was in the digital underground. Like, I don't think, by and large, white people are even familiar with Tupac's career in the digital underground.
Absolutely, yeah. So then they've got Will Smith, Getting Jiggy With It.
Yeah, I would have thought for sure there'd been some summertime, something more.
And this one I thought should have been on it for sure. I'm, and in fact, I would have replaced Whoomp, There It Is, with this one, which is Rex and Effects, Rump Shaker.
Totally.
Because I feel like, for real, remember the girl playing the saxophone on the beach in the video? Man, white people were right about this one.
Boom, boom.
Just shake your rump.
That was Pharrell's first big hit, I think.
Mm-hmm. And then they had, they had people able to vote. And what deserved to be on the list was MC Hammer's You Can't Touch This, followed very closely by Snoop Doggy Dogg's Gin and Juice. Interesting.
Yeah.
Then they had update number two. The black people have spoken. And they checked out top 10 rock songs black people love, written by a black person.
Ooh.
Let's pop on over to that thing.
You have some Bon Jovi in there,
let's
maybe.
Let's see here. Smoke on the Water, Deep Purple, number one. Every black person secretly knows headbangs and plays air guitar to the opening riff on this one as soon as white people aren't watching. Gotta admit, yo, that opening part is deaf. You gotta admit. Give it up. Schoolboy Crush, Average White Band. Okay. We like it so much, we sampled it for rap about 2,887,745 times. Play That Funky Music, Wild Cherry.
Totally.
See number one. Pour Some Sugar on Me. Fill a room with black people. Start this video on the TV. And by the end of the second bar of that guitar intro, every black person is turning around watching the screen. If whites are in the room, we will smirk, nod, then resume talking and drinking with you. If no whites are in the room, one wannabe hardcore looking black guy will move in to switch the TV off saying, "What y'all watching that crazy white shit for?" Other black folk in the room will move in and block him from the TV. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Calm down. No. I like this. Guaranteed. Black folk, admit you've been in a room where this has happened.
For black people, the drummer has one arm.
True.
If you have a, and I'm not trying to be mean or anything, like ableism, but like it's drumming. Like you need to be able to do like a drum roll at some point.
Yeah.
That seems like two arms would be a prerequisite for being a drummer.
Yep. Number six, Don't Want to Fall in Love by Jane Childs. God damn, I love this song. All black women consider Jane Childs the most authentically black-sounding white woman who has ever sung a note in public. Jane tore up that song. Give it up, y'all. However, the white female rock song all black women secretly sing along to with no brothers or white folks sitting around watching is Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover, number seven, by Sophie B. Hawkins.
Okay.
Number 8, Tell It to My Heart, or anything by Taylor Dane. Admit it, sisters. We've all whispered to each other that Miss Dane looks or must be part black, because otherwise there's no way on earth she could sing that well if she wasn't at least part black, right? Anything by Sinatra. Now, I know Frank Sinatra doesn't qualify to many fools as a rock star, but according to the teenage girls of the 1940s, he was. And every black man in the recording industry wishes he were Frank and will be given instant big props to Old Blue Eyes. Black people are kind of like Italians. We all worship Frank Sinatra. We also wish Frank had been black because he was that cool. And finally, anything by Steely Dan or the solo Donald Fagen. All black people like Steely Dan. Any black folk who claim he doesn't hasn't heard them yet. Want to get black folks in a comfortable mood at a party when the lights are all low and night, and get them nice and friendly with white people also at the party? Throw on some Steely Dan and see how many colors mingle and black folks start waxing rhapsodic of how many white musicians are quite gifted. Once again, all black people like and will listen to Steely Dan. The Doobie Brothers came close on this black respect meter, but nothing touches the Dan. However, bear in mind that most people know rock music was created by black people, so this top 10 comparison might actually be kind of moot. Did I miss anything? Signed, a black woman named, oh yeah, all black folks also love Casey and the Sunshine Band.
I have to think there might be some omissions up here.
They mentioned Led Zeppelin, because all black people have at least a little respect for Zeppelin songs.
Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, that's rap songs that white people like and rock songs that black people like. Interesting.
And I was just thinking, was the, from Saturday Night Live, was it rap song, this is my rap song.
Rap.
What was that character's name? Sandberg?
It was Sandberg, but I don't know what the guy's name was. And they always had like... He would be like, yeah, come on.
They had real rappers.
Let's go.
They had like real
All right, son. Rappity rap, 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 rap. It was like...
Well, the best was they always had real... Like, they would do that skit when they had, like, Ice Cube on. He's like, oh, he's the best, you know, from the day. Or, like, Snoop Dogg, like, real rappers.
Blizzard, I think.
Blizzard.
Right? Was it Blizzard Man?
Blizzard. I think it was Blizzard Man. God, I don't have...
You should look that up. That's so funny.
I don't have Informer queued up.
No, you shouldn't.
I should, though. Yeah. Blizzard Man. Oh, my God.
I'm looking at it.
And with 2 Chainz and T-Pain.
Yeah.
I'll do 2 Chainz.
Yeah, do 2 Chainz.
Okay.
Do that one.
Fucking Yahoo, come on. Yahoo? That's supposed to be Google. The Googles.
The Googles.
How come it's not playing? Do you have one queued up?
I can. I don't know if it's going to play, though.
And it's a commercial.
Of course.
First of all, Yahoo, you took about a damn hour to get that up there, and then you play a commercial. I hate Yahoo. Why are you still in business? Seriously?
And I don't know.
Shit is... ugly. It's like
it's
purple, and it's
so bad.
It looks like it's just blah. Like, has anybody done anything to their homepage?
Mm.
And just all these goddamn.
Are they the ones that got rid of their home? Work, people can't work from home no more, or something.
Yeah, Blizzard Man.
It's such an honor to be in the studio with the one and only 2 Chainz.
Honor's all mine. Chainz, the tracks are banging, but we still need a hook for that second single.
I feel you. But not to worry, I got just the man for the job.
Who, Pitbull?
Kulo!
nah, better. The Blizzard Man.
He's got the frosted tips. Man. It's so funny.
I heard
funny.
He dropped out the game. Disappeared down the rabbit hole of his own genius. Like a hip-hop Bobby Fischer.
That's him right there.
My man.
Really? Look, he's got the 8-ball jacket on.
You want to do the thing?
Yeah.
Get in the booth, fool. So, that's the Blizzard Man?
I know what you're thinking. But the man has the same exact swag as ASAP Rocky and the street cred of Catherine Heidel.
So he's a soldier.
Exactly. Yo, Blizzy. You ready to do this thing, man? Just let the music move through you, baby.
Trill. Yo, I'm about to set it. It's your boy, Blizz Nasty. On worst behavior. Check my style out. Rap song. Boogie on the floor and yell the time. The ladies look tighter than a country ham. So I make them put their boobs on my butt. Yo, the devil is a lie.
Are you gonna stop there? The rap devil is
song,
a lie.
Rap song.
That's the name of the episode. The devil is a lie.
The devil is alive.
Yep.
People are going to see Very White Guy and The Devil is Alive. They're going to make some associations. I'm okay with that. I'm just telling you that's going to happen.
Well.
The devil is alive.
Well. Well, did you hear?
It's for the devil being alive.
Speaking of the devil, did you hear that the president of Argentina, Juan Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, had a magical moment last week when she supposedly ended a young man's werewolf curse.
Wait a minute. Did you just, is that, were you reading the headline?
Yeah.
Had a magical moment.
Yeah, here we go. That is if you believe South American folklore. Kirchner.
The Cupacabra.
Kirchner shared photos from a Hanukkah candle lighting ceremony on her blog and described adopting a young Jewish man named Yair Tawil. According to reports, he is the seventh son of his family. But as centuries-old legend goes, the seventh son is supposedly cursed to become a werewolf on every full moon after his 13th birthday, unless he is adopted by another family. Seventh daughter supposedly become witches, FYI. Meanwhile...
It's un Kabbalah, no? Mm-hmm.
No, a Kabbalah is like a superstition.
A superstition, okay.
This is something entirely different. Meanwhile, Argentina's...
Folklore.
Yes, this is folklore. Meanwhile, Argentina's presidents, since 1907, have been adopting, symbolically anyway, seventh children as part of a custom brought over by Russian immigrants, according to the Guardian newspaper. The custom over time has been linked to the werewolf legend and the idea that families are desperate to avoid the superstitious stigma of having a cursed child. The presidential practice of adopting godchildren as traditionally involved Catholic-born kids, but that was...
seven kids? You think they're Catholic with seven of them? I don't know.
But that was changed by decree in 2009. Under Argentine law, seventh children adopted by the president receive a gold medal and an education scholarship until they turn 21. Last Tuesday's ritual was the first time someone of the Jewish faith was adopted by a president. Yair's parents, Shlomo and Nahama Tawil, had first written a letter asking that their seventh son be adopted in 1993 when he was born, reported the Jewish Telegraphic Agency.
Wait a minute. So she adopted his ass like at the deadline, like right before his 13th
birthday?
That's what
they always do. That's the tradition.
Like
you do it so you stop it.
The turkey on Thanksgiving Day?
Right.
I see.
Kirchner never referenced the werewolf myth in her blog about the ceremony, but said in a series of tweets that the moment was, quote, magical, and that the Tawils are a marvelous family. And she has a picture of her with all of them. The dude... But the thing is, I don't see which one she's adopting.
There's more than one 13-year-old.
No, there's more than one of the people in this family. It's like, I don't see a 13-year-old. The one dude looks like, I mean, he's like posing like, hey. It's ridiculous.
Look for the werewolf.
I don't see the werewolf. I don't see.
Look for the one with the hairy arms. No?
No, doesn't exist. There is a menorah and... Yeah,
we could go on. We have like an entire series of podcasts about our time in Argentina, like because we lived there for a couple of years and it was
true,
kind of in some ways magical and crazy and weird and fucked up. But like, I'll just say, all seven of those kids, one moped.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's true. They will put a. Oh my gosh, I'd be scared for those babies. Sometimes you'd see them with like 13 people. Not really, but. It'll be like two kids and two people.
I don't think
like
I ever saw six, but I think I saw five.
Four I saw. I don't know if I saw five, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Sure
I saw five. I don't know if I saw. I mean, I'm not disputing that because I totally would see it
with
easily.
Like the fender on the bottom.
Easily
we all, like, drag
could see it.
Ground.
Yeah, I could totally see it. I'm just saying I didn't. I don't know if I saw five, personally speaking. But so, yeah. So, well, congrats to you, Yael.
Congrats.
You won't be a werewolf. How about that?
I think it's the yerba mate.
The yerba.
Makes you a fucking werewolf, dude.
Yeah, what's the saying? You about no hay yerba?
it was a sex joke, wasn't
right,
it?
Right, it's a sex joke, yeah.
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 So I don't even know if I can tell the joke, but I'll just tell the punchline. And we're living in Argentina. I don't know any Spanish hardly at all.
And oh, right, because the joke is Spanish. It doesn't make any sense in English.
Doesn't make
You're
any
right.
Spanish.
Like, I'm thinking of it in my head in Spanish, course. And I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, it's funny. You
That's
can tell
it's
it.
A sex joke.
But you can't tell
you
it.
Can't
it's,
really tell
it's
it.
Spanish.
I mean, I could. But,
nobody, well, I mean, maybe some of their listeners speak Spanish.
Well, anyway,
but anyways,
it's not just a joke. It's like a colloquialism. It's almost like why the chicken cross the road.
Like, it's just
everybody
like
that. Knows it.
Yes,
everybody
yes.
knows it.
That's exactly what it is.
The punchline is no hay hierba, no hay hierba.
Oh, you can kind of tell the joke in English. In English, the joke would be that...
Oh, like, what do we want to do? There's nothing to do.
There's nothing to do. There's nothing to do. Well...
We could fuck.
We could... Right, we could fuck, or we could have a mate, which is like have a tea time, and then... The guy would say, "Well, I'm out of tea. So it's obvious that's what they're going to go
right.
do.
Right. So, but the
it's like an afternoon delight joke.
It is. That's a bunch of us. Afternoon delight joke. But so the and it's such a colloquialism there.
Yeah,
that you don't
like,
even tell the joke.
Yeah,
you just
like,
literally say, "No, I."
It's like that's what she said.
It kind of, but you would literally look at somebody and go, "No, I share mate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any tea.
I don't have any."
Right, so or in particular, I was like, "Well, what do you want to do?" I don't have any mate.
Right,
you know, like, "Hey, wink, wink, I don't got any fucking mate."
Mm-hmm.
So I come barreling in like day two, and I'm into mate sherba, and I've kind of got away from it. I'm drinking coffee again, but I didn't drink coffee there. I drink mate, and it's got caffeine. It's delicious and whatever. But I scream at the top of my lungs, like, "No hay hierba. I don't have any hierba."
Everybody lost it.
They fucking thought it was great.
It was great because you always were saying stuff like that. You'd have like all your Morticia moments where you meant.
I was talking about more chairs and I asked for blood sausage.
Yeah, that was a good one. Or that.
I wipe with whores.
That's right. Mi remera.
Yeah.
Es mi servicheta. Right. No, that's not right.
A is a. I don't even know now. A, with an A, it's a one word. And with an E, it's another word.
Correct.
Ramera, Remera. Ramera, Remera.
Ramera and Remera. Remera.
One is a polo t-shirt and the other is a prostitute.
One's your teacher and one is a whore. Yeah.
And I said I was just going to wipe with my whore.
Uh-huh. Comida por un porro.
Yeah, I was feeding my joint.
That was funny.
Well, that was part of my... My own enjoyment. I can laugh at myself, and I wanted to learn the language and immerse myself.
That one was
myself.
The funniest because all the waiters got in on the joke, and they
was
were like
hilarious.
Making fun of you so bad.
So now you got to talk. So I said I was at a restaurant, and a very American thing to do is take food home, and that's not a very Argentinian thing.
No, we finish our food.
Yeah. So we're eating at 11 o'clock at night. They eat late as shit. So we're like going to like a steakhouse.
Yeah, steakhouse at like 10:30.
It was a really
normal.
Good meal. It was a really good meal. It was like a combination T-bone filet mignon. They call
it
beef and chorizo. Mm-hmm. So I'm eating the thing. I'm like, oh, I've got too much. I want to take it home. And the guy gave me a little look like, oh, you're taking it home. So I meant to say I'm bringing it home for my dog, which was a total lie. I was going to eat it, but I was embarrassed. So I was trying to like pawn it off on the dog. Like my dog ate my homework. So I was like, oh, you know, comida pony. And I meant to say, perro, perra, my dog, but I said porro, which
porro.
Is kind of like a burro, but it's slang for a joint,
a blunt or whatever.
So the guy's like, what?
Porro, porro.
And everyone's laughing.
They're laughing.
So the best, though, is the dude packs up the food. He's got it in like a styrofoam to-go container, and he's in the side station, like away from, like, you know, around where, not where we're seated, like where the waiters go to get your, like, you know,
drinks and
shit. The side station. So he's out of view, but he's off to the side, and he must have been fucking just waiting, just like standing there, because, like, you know, mozos and that's a waiter in Argentina, they're not exactly the, like, get you out of there quick kind of people.
No,
they're just standing around.
Leisurely dinner.
Very leisurely.
Yeah, dinner, you know.
So he's standing around, and he just catches my eye, and he puts the whole box of food up to his mouth like a doobie and takes
like he's smoking it.
Takes a couple
comida
of big puffs.
Por un porro. It's so great.
That's not even the best part. The best part is it was our friend's birthday.
I-Day.
Hi, I-Day. Shout out, I-Day. Good evening. July 9th. In fact, Independence Day.
Yes.
Nueve de Julio. So it's the best, one of the best producers in town. So the next year, her birthday,
we go back. Yeah.
And we haven't been in since. Maybe we have, but I don't know. But it's her birthday again, a full year later.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I should preface in Argentina and La Plata, where we live specifically, I stand out like a big, giant white thumb. not because I'm white, but because like the Argentinian individuals are not, I wouldn't say they're diminutive, but they're not as, I'm extra large for American. I'm like mega size Argentinian.
You're like,
right?
Yeah.
Well, you got it. Like, okay, here's the, who do you know that's Argentinian? Lionel Messi.
Yeah.
And he had to get like growth hormone to reach 5'4".
And
right?
His nickname is La Pulga, which means the flea. The flea.
Right. So I'm literally like multiple people I work with, I could pick up with like each arm and swing around.
Right.
I'm a large dude in Argentina. And even then I was, you know, 70, 80, 100 pounds heavier. So we walk into the restaurant right away without skipping a beat.
Not even a
comida para porro. Screaming and shit.
We all lost it. Ide couldn't even breathe. She was laughing so hard. It was the funniest thing. It was great. Oh, I miss Argentina.
Yeah, I couldn't get away with buffoonery. Jaywalking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so yeah, maybe I'll tell some Argentine stories another time too. Maybe some of our travel stories.
Yeah, it was
kind of fun. Okay.
What are we talking about? TV shows?
TV shows. So
we need a bumper for TV shows.
Yeah, we don't have one
like
yet.
Like some sort of like.
Oh, I should have the girls do something with that.
Yeah. Hmm. Oh, a TV thing.
Another day.
Another day.
The Wire. Five days. Five motherfucking buddy. Seasons.
Yeah, buddy.
You know, I haven't watched any episodes since we watched the whole binge watched all of them.
Right.
So I watched it in this format the first time we watched it, where we just were like fucking consumed with it. Like we were like, okay, is there time to get one more in? Like we just were just trucking through
it's
them.
Funny, you're speaking of Argentina. That was in Argentina.
Yeah, because we didn't have any TV there. So we were like, we might as well just download.
And we had Pirate Bay.
Oh, right, because you can torrent everything there. They don't have copyright laws in Argentina.
I would just fucking at night. And
I'm
not
joking about that either. They do not have copyright laws in Argentina.
But at night, we would download a bunch. And we watched like 3, 4 a day, 5 a day.
Oh, yeah.
And that was on a work day.
Yep.
And on a weekend, we were watching like 7, 8, 9.
Oh, yeah, we were not playing.
I think we watched all, is it 6 seasons?
5 seasons.
It wasn't about a month.
I don't even think it was the week. I mean,
no,
I really.
It was over a week.
Not much more.
Not much. It was a couple of weeks.
Two weeks, maybe.
Yeah.
It was very quick. But it's just so fantastic. I mean,
McNulty, Bonk.
Seeing it again, every episode, I don't care what episode comes on, I'm like, yes, this is a great one. They're all amazing.
Yeah.
So the other night, though, they had one of the few sex scenes. Because it wasn't a heavy sex show. They showed a few people, but not with any regularity. It wasn't any... none of the romantic relationships were at the heart of any of the stories. I'll put it that way. Let's just say that.
Who are you talking about? McNulty and...
No, I'm talking about Kima having...
I know you're going to
So we're sitting on the couch.
You're about to make fun of me.
I am going to make fun of you.
You stink.
We're sitting on the couch, and the Twitter was distracting you per usual. And
guilty.
And I said, Drew, look at that. There's black lesbians having sex on TV. And you looked up and your face, you were like, oh, there really are black lesbians having sex on TV.
I mean, you know how to, you know the right words. You got my attention, didn't you?
You were like, you can always tell me when that's happening. I was like, yeah, I bet.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Yeah. But I love all the characters on the show. Stringer, oh, so sad when he got killed, even though he was the bad guy. And it's so funny because my mom's never seen any of it. And while they were here over the weekend, we all were watching them as they were on. And so she watched a few and she said, oh, those are the good guys. And I didn't say anything. And then she said, oh, those are the bad guys. And she said the good guys were the cops that she was showing that were there. And then the bad guys were the drug dealers or some of the other people they were showing. And then it just happened that one episode she said that, the very end, the cops totally did the most horrible, like immoral, horrible shit. And I looked at her and she goes, huh, I don't think either of these people are good guys or bad guys. And I was like, yes, that right there is the fucking beauty of The Wire, because that's reality.
It's just so goddamn well done.
It's so well done. And just, so many people in it are doing huge things. Like, I've forgotten had so many of the people that are in it that were in smaller roles on this show but are huge now. A lot of people from The Walking Dead alone.
The Walking Dead has literally Tyrone, Bob, friggin' the
Carter. Yeah. That's three right there.
Black dudes that were on The Wire.
They can't all be on there at the same time, though.
Well, Bob's done. He got eaten.
Yeah, exactly. Got to keep that number down.
And you know, not to go into talking about Walking Dead because it's not on, but we've been talking about T getting kind of chunky. right? He's looking like he's the
Tyrone.
Yeah, he's the healthiest.
Yeah, he's the like fattest post-apocalyptic dude I've ever seen. Where he's like gotten heavier since he came on. I'm like,
on the wire,
and he's one of those dudes where he's built like you can't tell is it chunky? Did he just lift weights?
His character was running the gym, right? He was going to kill that guy.
Well, he's very barrel chested.
No, but he was ripped. He was ripped.
I'm saying though, he's got a big frame on the top in particular. And when people like that gain a bit of weight, like sometimes it looks like if they're wearing the right clothes, like they just might be huger. So you don't know. He's always wearing stuff where like his stomach is covered and you can't tell. Like, is that pinned in there? Or is he just like buffed out of it? I don't know.
Interesting.
I don't know.
But yeah, and then they had the episode we just watched was when Omar got pinched and he's in jail.
Right, he's in jail.
They tape all those fucking books onto his stomach.
Yep.
And the guy tries to shank him and he ends up fucking him up.
Yeah, he sure does.
How's that for a message? Shit's crazy, dude.
Yeah, that show is so good.
I absolutely love it. It's just so good.
And my favorite character in the whole series, though, I say this all the time, was Bodhi. I don't know why. It felt like he was... I love the realism of the show, and to me, he was one of the most real characters because I felt like he's somebody I grew up with.
Who's the white teacher that?
No, that's Presbulewski.
Presbulewski.
No, Bodhi's one of the kids on the corner, but he grows up and he was like running a crew.
Oh no! He's the guy that had the do-rag on the one.
Yes,
I know Bodhi. Absolutely.
I just loved his character. I thought he always reacted the way like I think a rational person would react to everything.
Well,
like he was always like, yeah, I'm just gonna say what the normal shit would be. I'm not outrageous. I'm not crazy. I'd just be like, wait, what are they gonna let us do? All right, well, we'll try it out.
And
he was very pragmatic. I loved that
when he was talking to Weebay's.
Girl,
and he's talking about the kid. He wants to give him a package.
Wayman.
Like, he's a fuck up. I ain't giving him shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Bodhi. And he even says, man, your mom is a dragon lady. And she's like, he's like, what? He's like, that gives me a lot of insight. And he's like, how's that? He goes, well, it tells me why you are the way you are, at least. Like, kind of like, you no wonder you're fucked up. Your mama? Mm-mm. You messed up.
I mean, she fucking basically kicked him out the car, says, get on the corner, make me money.
You got to step up now.
Step up now. Make me proud.
On to another fantastic show that was on hiatus in our life and in the world, which is The Comeback on HBO.
Valerie Cherish.
Fucking A. Lisa Kudrow just
slays
the role. She produces the show with Michael King. I just think everything about it is pitch perfectly wonderful. You see this character with flaws and all, but it's still a funny show. I don't know how they've managed to do it. Wow. I don't think there's any comedy on television that recently in the last 10 years that has been able to capture that thing.
And I think what they've done better than anyone I've ever seen, and I don't know how much of it is scripted versus like Larry David improv, like characterizations that you then, you know, play out to some degree, because there is some element that seems like that, especially with her parts.
Right? I don't know. I feel like it's pretty scripted.
Well, but it is even more kudos. The meta, triple meta, right? Because if you watch the first comeback,
right,
it's about her character, who used to be on a show called It's Me, that was all about her, called It's Me.
In the 80s.
In the 80s. It was a huge hit, like many, 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 many years. And now she's coming back as this sort of like, you know, matriarchal school mom sort of character in a Friends-like environment, right?
Right. It would be like if Justine Bateman tried to have a comeback.
Right.
For real, had a comeback.
But so then that's the premise of they're shooting a show, and then they're shooting a reality show about her making this show.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about a reality show. It's about a character on a reality show about making a show. And that was like season one.
Mm-hmm.
So then on this comeback one, this one, they're filming another show that's about the guy that wrote the show that the first season of the comeback was about.
Right.
So
the second sitcom.
It's just so like you can't even almost keep track. I don't want to say it's meta, but it is. It's triple meta.
It is.
And the bit when he was making her blow him, the character's being played.
Oh my God, Seth Rogen.
Oh my shit.
It's fantastic.
And she's being filmed on this reality show. Oh, for Christ's
sake. And everything about it, like the reality show produced, director and producer Jane, she's
fucking
like,
love it.
She's so, in the first one, and in this one, she's totally like, this is what I went to film school for. Like, upset that she's been forced into to get work and to do work. This is the work she could get, is to follow around this narcissistic, washed up television star as part of basically a promotional tool for this TV show. And then this time now, the show's on HBO. So she's now doing an HBO reality document. And it showed how she was much more forceful and demanding in this. Like, nope, I got to get that shot. She wasn't totally like that the first time around. It's such a statement on how reality TV itself has changed. This is why the show is so fucking brilliant. It's such a statement it's such a statement about the industry and the fact that Lisa Kudrow's making it, somebody who has had enormous success in this machine. It's just, and Michael King as well with Sex and the City. I think it's just really smart, and I just loved everything about it, and the season finale was fantastic. And
couldn't agree
if Lisa
more.
Kudrow doesn't get nominated for an actual Emmy for this, which is part of the plot of the show, because
really
Valerie
is.
Cherish
really
gets that same opportunity, I just think it would be a crying shame, because it was a triumph. And I really hope they come back again, and I hope they don't wait 10 years to do
it. Yeah, agreed. And in fact, her character in maybe I say it's been done, but she's probably does, because of the device, it's a reality show filming. So the device is your HBO, but you're not watching the reality show like Lost Footage, right?
Right.
You're watching like
them filming.
Yes, you're watching like a three camera format of them filming the reality show, but then you never see the reality show cameraman or the producer woman to keep that sort of like pretense sort of done well. But then when then they do show you found footage, or rather than show you found footage, they'll show her basically filming the reality show break character and be like, Jane, can we do that again? Right. So she like this, like almost the device allows her to break that third wall in a way that's just absolutely delicious. You know what I mean?
Right. I think you're always very aware that the TV cameras and everything are there.
But I'm talking about her. Like, there's other shows. Like, I know Kevin Spacey does the show where he like leans in and goes,
but that's a device though. This is different.
I'm saying that this isn't a device. The device is the premise of the show that allows Lisa Kudrow to really have those same sort of Kevin Spacey whisper kind of moments with the audience. She's able to quote unquote break that wall, but just really seamlessly, hilariously, and as part of the it's not only plot, but it also builds the characters' neuroses. It's just awesome.
It does, right. Because it's like she's always on, and it actually gives you a really interesting thought process of like when somebody is actually filming a reality TV show, because they make it look like, you know, they're never in their way and they just go about their business and everything is just goes the way that it's supposed to go. And it's like, in reality, it's a fucking television shoot
for real.
You know, in reality, you're aware of everything that's going on, and there's makeup people, and there's all sorts of things that go on.
In reality, my battery died. Can you exit the limo again?
Yes, in reality.
Literally.
Yeah.
Can you, you know, we didn't get that shot.
Yeah.
David, can you come out of the limo again?
Well, I just thought it was great, and so watch it if you haven't watched it. And kudos, too.
And I think HBO is going to be doing a online like pay-as-you-go service starting January, so I think you might be able to.
And yeah, HBO is doing that starting January. You're right.
So you could even in a couple days.
You're right about that.
Pay for a fee and get Valerie Cherish streamed to your TV because it was awesome,
so good, and you can get The Wire too. So
highly recommended from the interracial John.
Go HBO.
Bam.
So while we were in Delaware, I actually got a little bit ill one of the days, and you went to a party without me, and I kind of stuck around and just was laying about on the couch at a friend's house, and on PBS, the most glorious thing was on.
What's that?
Motown 25.
What's that, the 25th anniversary or what's Motown 25?
Motown 25 is the television special that aired celebrating Motown's 25th anniversary. And
it came on
in 1983.
I know.
And
okay,
it commemorated Motown's 25th year. It was taped before a live studio audience at the Pasadena Civic Auditorium in Pasadena, California on March 25th, 1983, and broadcast on May 16th. Among its highlights were Michael Jackson's performance of Billie Jean, Smokey Robinson's long-awaited reunion with the Miracles, A Temptations, Four Tops' Battle of the Bands, Marvin Gaye's inspired speech about black music history and his memorable performance of What's Going On, a Jackson 5 reunion, an abbreviated reunion of Diana Ross and the Supremes, who performed their final number one hit, Someday We Will Be Together, and it was amazing.
And that was, Michael Jackson debuted the moonwalk. There was a bunch of seminal moments, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was like literally when you were watching it. Here's my thing, though. Maybe it didn't resonate with you as much. And
It's 83. I would have been 12.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm probably, I don't think I would have watched it. I don't think I would have sat around the TV and watched it like perhaps you or your family did.
Definitely not, because you're white. Yeah. So for us, it was like, holy crap. Like, every black person is going to be on television, on major television. Like, you can watch it. They're going to be performing. It was like huge. And these were big stars in the world, much less in our world. But for us, they were our heroes. So it was like a huge to-do in my household. Like, my mom VHS'd it, like taped it. And we like watched it multiple times. And it was glorious. And so I was just ecstatic to be able to watch it again.
And they rebroadcast the whole thing, or was it with commentary?
No. They had a few breaks because it was on PBS, and that's what they do, you know.
Sure.
They take the breaks to do whatever. But also because they're selling the Motown 25. I think you can buy it now.
Makes sense. So they're selling the DVD.
It's basically like Motown paid for an infomercial on PBS, and PBS said, great, but we get to show the show, which would get them ratings.
Got it.
Makes sense. So they showed it, and it was just so, so good. Everything about it was so good. All the music was amazing. The Temptations and Four Tops, sing off was insane. It was a battle of the bands between the fucking Temptations and the Four Tops.
Wow.
And it was so good.
Speaking of Temptations, your sister, remember, not to go off tangent, but your sister was making fun of us when we did the recording of the I Can't Breathe challenge.
Yeah.
And I fucked up the soul clap and shit. She said it was like that we thought we was coming in all like Temptations, but it was more like David Ruffin.
No, that's not what she said. You didn't understand the reference. David Ruffin left the Temptations, and then he came back, and it was David Ruffin and the Temptations for a while.
Oh, so she was saying we were David Ruffin separate. And the Temptations?
Yes, Junie said that. He was like, yeah, we thought we were the Temptations, but really we were David Ruffin and the Temptations, which is like not the Temptations at all.
So we were the also-ran Temptations.
Yes, the also-ran Temptations, exactly. Also, one of the co-hosts was Richard Pryor. So watching it now is even more poignant because so many of these people are gone. Michael's gone. He's gone. Marvin Gaye was gone. He was killed very shortly after this. I think a few of the women, I can't remember all of them. I think maybe Mary Wilson has passed away. Yeah, I think so as well. And I know a couple of the Temptations and or Four Tops has passed away as well. Nick Ashford has passed away already. So is a lot of people that have passed since this 25 years. They had this really cool bit with the guys from WKRP in Cincinnati, Howard Hessman and Tim Reed. They played Johnny Moshita Jr. and TJ Shepherd. They were the DJs.
Yeah.
So they had this whole bit where they would introduce a song and they'd be all animated about it taking over the airways and da 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 da. And then a light would come on the other side of the stage and that person would be there live. So instead of playing the record, the person would be singing the song. It was amazing. And they did it for like 15 fucking minutes. And Dick Clark did a bit of it. It was so well done. That was the thing that really struck me was I don't even think they do shows like this anymore where it's like so many moving pieces, so much of the stage like moved physically. It was really crazy and big.
You know, I feel like, and I don't know why I feel like this, but on some level, performances at award shows have gotten not stale. There hasn't been much innovation. You know, it's the same sort of like stage, you know, all these LEDs and you know what I'm saying? Like, I haven't seen, I guess Beyonce is pretty innovative, but aside from her, maybe that's what it takes, is a lot of money. to be that kind of innovative.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does take that to put on a huge stage production. Yeah, I think so.
She's definitely innovative. She, even when she did remember the one she did with the LED board?
Oh my God, that was amazing.
Where it was like the hat, it was the half her body.
It was her, and you couldn't tell where she was.
Yeah, that was fucking great.
She was catching balls and all sorts of shit.
That's innovative. That's innovative.
Oh, she's very innovative. I'll tell you, she is if nothing if not an artist. And I mean that in the like most...
So maybe that's why you don't see as much of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's rare anyways, but I think when you have Suzanne DePass from Motown Records producing and directing a show, it's going to be fucking spectacular. She's it. So, but the best part of the show obviously was the Jackson 5 reunion and with Michael Jackson. So it started with the Jackson 5 and they did a whole medley. They did I Want You Back. They did the Love You Save. They did Never Can Say Goodbye. And they did I'll Be There. Randy came out because Jermaine left and Randy had joined him. So Randy came out too. It was just really, really good. That part was so good. They sounded so good together. They were dancing so well together. And there's a part in the song. Let me see if I actually might even have that. There's a part in one of the songs, one of the medleys that they did, that was like Jermaine's mic didn't work.
Huh.
Like in the middle of it going on live, his mic just wasn't working correctly. And it went out. He couldn't do his solo because he was a solo artist as well. Now, I'll admit he wasn't as big an artist as Michael was, but he was an artist. And so he had a little moment to shine. And so his mic wasn't working. And Michael runs over to share his mic with him, hands it to him to sing. They have a little breakdown part. And there's a part where he says, I'll keep holding on. And he hangs on to Michael really tight. That. It's just so pretty.
Poignant.
And just to think, so here's his little brother.
He even gives him a double squeeze. Here we go. A double squeeze.
I'll be your strength.
You get a little double squeeze, right?
Double squeeze. Oh my God, they sound fucking amazing. Forget it. The voice
of a lifetime.
Fucking ridiculous. The whole room was singing. It was amazing.
I don't know anyone, regardless of what you think or feel of Michael Jackson as a person, right? Whether, this or that, you can't deny the man's voice.
Oh, no, his voice.
You can't deny his talent
in
singing.
It's just insane. He's just... Anyways, the show was so good. I was just so... If you can catch it on PBS, I just recommend doing it because it was just... Everybody was so good. And Marvin Gaye did an entire breakdown. He just sat at the piano and basically played riffs and talked about how black music had shaped the history of this country and what music can do, and the feelings that it can invoke, like freestyled, and then got up and fucking killed What's Going On. It was insanity. Well, anyways, so that was really just seeing it at all. I feel like I need to buy the goddamn DVD because it was so good. That's probably what they intended, though, probably.
That's probably that's the intended outcome. But you should buy the DVD.
Yeah,
for sure. Do it. Go for it.
So, so that's it for me. What do you got going on?
I guess we could stand for some podcasts.
Well, yeah, tonight, I don't know if we'll get this up before we go live, but we will be participating in Chonilla's second annual Festivus 2014.
Grievances.
Yeah, so we'll be airing the grievances, beginning of the Festivus dinner, spaghetti, and a red sauce, of course. Each participant tells friends and family of all the instances where they disappointed him or her that year, including things that make you tick in current events, people from work, etc.
I'm on it. I gotta start working my grievances.
Get your grievances together.
I didn't do all of them, but we got some of the youngest ones. Charlize, we got her to say a couple of things.
Yeah.
And see if I can play it here. Oh, wait a minute. I gotta turn it up. Play this again. So she was absolutely enamored with my bell, my sound
and
effect.
And I'll
bell.
Say, when I put the headphones on her and the mic, she said she couldn't. She was so enamored with the sound of her voice. It was great.
It's interesting. I don't know if I ever got to do that with Ciara because she was complaining about not liking the way her voice sounds. And I said, well, that sounds exactly how it sounds to us, but it sounds different to you because you've got your hearing's closer to the source than we are.
Right.
But anyway, here's a...
I love the bell.
The laugh. Here, do it again.
I love the bell.
And then what else we got from is that all we got from her?
No, she did the news. You could have played that earlier, but
oh, I could have played the news. Let me see here. The news is coming on. I didn't do that. There you go.
The news is coming on. The news is coming on. The news is coming on. The news is
come on. That's so great.
And there, this is actually, I'll save, I have one more, but I'll save that for the end.
Okay. So again, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio at Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. And of course, on our website, interracialjohn.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram at Interracial John, again J-A-W-N. You can find me on Twitter at Leslie Mac M-A-C and my cohort at A Very White A Guy.
Correctamundo.
That's
good
right.
Good night, everybody.
Oh, she even has the bell at the end.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
High five.